using free speech to free minds. You're listening to The David Knight Show.
As the clock strikes 13, it's Wednesday, the 10th of November, year of our Lord, 2021, day 604 of the emergency. Today we're going to take a look at what is happening as we have the CEO of Pfizer projecting. He says, these people who are putting out misinformation are killing people. They're criminals. Yeah, it was the CEO of Pfizer who said that. We'll have updates on the mandates as well as the new world orders. And Tony Arterburn will be joining us in the third hour to talk about crypto, how to start, and some safe good practices. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Well, as we look at the news, one of the first things that stood out to me, as I've talked in the past about religious leaders who now, because they have shrugged off any moral concerns about the manufacturing or testing of these drugs using ground-up babies, basically murder for hire, which is still ongoing with the development of these pharmaceutical drugs. As they shrug that off, as they shrug off any concern about mark of the beast, but now some of them, as I pointed out yesterday, are finally paying attention to the civil liberties violations after these religious leaders have shrugged off all the moral and ethical and religious issues. Now they focus on the politics of it. But one of the people who has been a cheerleader in the past for this, Franklin Graham, and he was there in New York at the epicenter of this so-called pandemic that was used to panic everybody into a state of medical martial law and slavery. He was right there at the epicenter of that. He saw as well as anybody else. There was no need for him to help. They went to help, and then they saw their help wasn't needed, and so they went home. But they became a cheerleader for the vaccine, and now it's been reported that he's recovering from heart surgery. That he has, and he's 69 years old. I understand this could be just a coincidence that he got pericarditis, which is one of the well-known symptoms of both of these mRNA vaccines. I don't know which one he got, but the post on his Facebook page said that the surgery involved removing the pericardium. And we thank God that it went well. The team here at the Mayo Clinic does an incredible job. I couldn't speak more highly of them. He had developed constrictive pericarditis, an inflammation and hardening of the sac around the heart, which involves compression of the heart. So we certainly do not rejoice in any of this, whether this is from his age or whether it is from the vaccine. I hope that he recovers. I just wish that some of these religious leaders would lead in terms of religion. I wish that they would have the discernment to understand what is happening to them. We have France now saying that people under 30 should not get the Moderna vaccine. Is this only a risk for people under 30? Or is this because if you're 69 years old and are not an athlete, they can easily dismiss it by saying that it is something else? No, what they're doing is they're limiting it for the people under 30 because for them, they can't explain it away. But for somebody who is in their 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s, it's just a comorbidity, except they didn't apply that standard when we went into the panic lockdown. Yeah, I'll probably die of a heart attack, but it'll be from the old-fashioned causes, a lack of sleep and exercise. It won't be because I've taken one of these genetic code, they actually call it, Moderna actually calls it the spike vax. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. This is like straight out of the Babylon Bee, the spike vax, because that's what it does. It starts your body to manufacture this toxic spike. It's not a vax. They could have called it the spike jab. They could have called it the Trump spike. Now, that's what it should have been called. Well, I can really get people upset with me on social media when I call it the Trump shot or I call it the Trump juice. Trump wants credit for it. He's constantly crowing that he's not getting enough credit for it. Mark Levin was at the beginning of the year. Now he's telling people, oh, this is, you don't want to mandate this. Yeah, but give Trump credit for it. Well, that's great. And he should get credit for it. Go ahead and mandate it. We already paid taxes for it, right? What's the deal, Levin? Just own it. Come on. I don't know how they sit on the fence like this. But, you know, I sometimes call it the Trump juice, the Trump shot. I call it the Trump Kool-Aid. As a matter of fact, I think the best name for this is Trump AIDS. Trump AIDS. It's being pushed by the Trump AIDS, but it gives you kind of an acquired immune deficiency, doesn't it? It'd be AIDS as an acquired immune deficiency shot, a shot to give you acquired immune deficiency and heart disease, myocarditis, pericarditis, these things that nobody had ever heard of. They've now become household words thanks to Pfizer. But, you know, move along. There's nothing to see here. As they point out in the articles covering this from Reuters, this is Reuters, saying, well, you know, France isn't going to give it to anybody under 30 because we might figure out that this thing is dangerous. They say the emergency use authorization earlier this year found a possible link between a very rare inflammatory heart condition and the COVID vaccines from both Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines. However, even though they identified this, they say that the benefit outweighs the risk. Well, no, I don't take things that I know are going to increase my risk of heart disease. End of story. And what universe do these numbers add up to say that it outweighs the risk? Are you kidding me? So Moderna, as they're going to push this out to the kids, by the way, again, this is all about perception. Pfizer, when it went down to the youngest age group so far, the 5 to 11, they said, we're going to do this at one-third the dose for adults. So if you're 12, you get the full adult dose. But if you're 11, you get the one-third dose. Yeah. Go figure. Yeah. It's just like the FDA. It's either approved or it isn't approved. And if it's approved, it's 100% safe. And if they haven't approved it for this particular use, this is the whole thing about ivermectin. People have been using it for decades for a lot of different conditions. Same thing with hydroxychloroquine. Its safety profile is very, very well known. And the risks involved in it are very well known. But you don't use it for anything other than these specific conditions that they have approved it for. And so, anything else, it's horse medicine or it's unsafe, that type of thing. But when Moderna, so Pfizer's going to reduce it by a third. And by the way, they have already set up 28 million little miniature kitty doses of their toxic poison. That's already been stockpiled. Just like Trump had already started manufacturing all of the hundreds of millions of these things before they even began any of their two-month tests. It was a done deal. It was a done deal. So it's a done deal for the kids as well. 28 million of them have already been stockpiled at one-third the adult dose. Now, Moderna is pushing this, and they're going to cut their dosage down by half. See, Pfizer is a little bit smarter. They don't want to get caught with kids dropping dead. Of course, they will. And then when that happens, they'll just deny that it happened, and the media will cover up for them. But they won't want that to happen too much of the time. Moderna, on the other hand, is just cutting their dosage by 50%. Dr. Linda Wastilla, who was part of the Ron Johnson hearings last week, and of course he invited all of the key players to come and speak and to give their side. Fauci, the NIH, Francis Collins at the NIH, Rochelle Walensky at the CDC. They never showed up, by the way. But he did have a lot of victims of these people who showed up. Oh, he invited all of the CEOs to show up as well. We've got the CEO of Pfizer saying anybody that gives out misinformation or disinformation is criminal and they should be prosecuted. But he won't show up to defend his own product. He won't show up in a forum where people who have been injured and are silenced and left untreated, he won't show up in that kind of a forum. But we did have Dr. Linda Wastilla, who is a physician, and she said, how can all of these deaths following COVID shots not be a concern? And of course, you know, the graph that I've shown you many times, which is, it's kind of hard to see. It just looks like an axis there because you plot this out over 30 years, and these are the reported deaths for other vaccines cumulative, and all of a sudden it just goes straight up. And it looks like you got an axis on the right-hand side because it's a vertical line going straight up. 8,083 in the U.S. deaths so far. And globally, 17,128 deaths reported. She said, we are citizens who have done our civic duty, but when we suffer serious adverse effects, we're left high and dry by the FDA, the CDC, the NIH, and by the medical profession. We are scientists alarmed by the toxic environment in academia and scientific publishing. We are military leaders concerned about vaccine safety and the armed services. We're clinicians who want to treat patients harmed by the vaccines, but whose practices are limited by our employers, the hospitals, and by professional boards. We are lawyers and patient advocates seeking help for our injured clients and their families. We're the people you haven't heard from. And we have nothing, absolutely nothing, to personally gain from being here. Indeed, we have everything to lose, including our jobs, our titles, and our livelihoods. But we don't intend to go away until we see some real change. She went on to talk about the issues with myocarditis. She said it took 4 months into Israel's national vaccine campaign to recognize this side effect. That's because the fact that myocarditis generally strikes within days of dosing, particularly the second dose. And you notice that as the way that we define this, you are not vaccinated until 2 weeks after the second dose. So officials are experiencing this side effect for months before officials recognize the vaccine as the cause. Why? Because of that crafty little definition. It's all about the definitions. Like I said, you know, they changed in October 2019 in a spending bill that was 700 pages long. They inserted one line to strike a single phrase out of the regulations defining vaccines. When they talked about vaccines, they specifically excluded synthesized polypeptides. And so they said, and we strike that. Now, nobody knew that synthesized polypeptides were mRNA, if they'd looked at it. It was buried in a funding bill, 550-some-odd pages into a 700-plus spending bill. So it's all about hiding this, just like they hide people who are having adverse effects by saying, well, you know, they weren't vaccinated. If they died sometime before the second dose, 2 weeks after the second dose. She said the delay in detecting, researching, and acknowledging side effects is normal. That's why, by the way, she doesn't say this, but that's why you run the test for 10 years. Because you want to take a look at that. You have a phase 1, a phase 2, a phase 3. They all go for about 3 years. We went into a phase 3 test for 2 months. It is devastating. The patients in this meeting today know that devastation firsthand. But it's also devastating because unless you first recognize harms soon after they occur, you can't use that knowledge in the next person who is about to get the vaccine. I'm stunned when I hear people dismiss myocarditis as an acceptable side effect, especially for young people. Because myocarditis is life-threatening and a life-disabling condition. And I've talked about this over and over again with the athletes. With athletes and with young people, they can't hide it. But somebody like Franklin Graham, they can't. Hey, 69 years old, and you know he's not real active, and so they can just dismiss it. Around the world, athletes are dropping like flies with heart problems, the headline from Vaccine Impact. Even the German mainstream media has picked up on what is happening, but they're very, very careful to avoid any connection to the vaccines because they're mainstream media. The Berliner Zeitung is the one that pulled this up. And they said in the body, as they went through and cataloged all these different soccer players, these people who run all the time, and you know they're in great shape, and they're dropping dead on the field or soon after, said puzzling heart diseases in football. An unusually large number of professional and amateur soccer players have collapsed recently. But, you know, it's just a coincidence. They're coincidence theorists. Never in the article, in the entire article, although they define and describe what is happening here and say, this is really strange. We're having a big surge in myocarditis. They never, ever link it to the vaccine. This might explain some of what is going on. I think this is interesting. I don't know if this is an effective treatment or not, but we have the feds trying to block promotion of a nasal spray against COVID-19. And this is interesting for a number of reasons. The manufacturer of this is the leading manufacturer of xylitol-based products, which is typically a sugar substitute sweetener. The federal government is deliberately trying to conceal a nasal spray that this company developed, that this company says has been scientifically proven to be effective in treating and preventing COVID-19. And so they're fighting this. They're not just being intimidated, which is typically what happens with natural substances. If the FDA sends you a letter, say, well, we don't like the claims that you made on this or the implications that you made on this, most people just pull their products off the shelf. But these people are fighting back because they said that they ran some scientific studies at Vanderbilt in Tennessee and at other places. So I said, we've got some data here to prove it. The U.S. Department of Justice, however, has filed a lawsuit against the Utah-based company X-Clear, saying that it has deceptively advertised its nasal spray as a treatment and a preventative of COVID-19. The lawsuit asks a federal court to permanently ban the company from promoting the nasal spray as treatment, and it also asks for monetary penalties to be levied. And so when you look at this, what the company has replied via their lawyer, they say, the attorney says, the commission is flat out lying about the company's claims being unsupported because the director who is head of the Bureau of Consumer Protection for the government said companies can't make unsupported health claims no matter what form a product takes or what it supposedly prevents or treats. Wait a minute. Companies can't make unsupported health claims no matter what form it takes. Does that mean that if you got an untested genetic code injection, a new novel approach that hasn't even gotten the scrutiny that we typically give to long-established vaccines or other things, that even if it takes the form of a vaccine, that they can't make unsupported health claims? We know those claims are unsupported because now we have the experiment that's been done on everybody for nearly a year. And so we know that those claims that they made back when they first said, we're done, after 2 months, we're done, 2 days after the election, you know, they come out and say, yeah, we're 94, actually it was 6 days after. They said they waited until the media coronated Biden on Saturday after the Tuesday, and then the following Monday, Pfizer came out and said, we're 90% effective. And then the Russians came out the next day and said, we're 93% effective. And then the following Monday, Moderna came out and said, we're 94% effective. And the next day, Pfizer said, we're 94.5%. It's just a game with these people. Those were unsupported health claims. And it doesn't matter that this is in the form of a vaccine for which they have no liability. They were lying. But now the government, the Samuel Levine The director of the Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection said in a press release, companies can't make unsupported health claims no matter what form a product takes or what it supposedly prevents or treats. I mean, even if it is the world's greatest plague, and this is the world's greatest plague, isn't it? COVID-19. Or is it? You see, that's one of the aspects of this that's kind of interesting. Unless you can't make unsupported health claims, no matter what form it's in, unless, of course, you're buddies with Fauci and Trump and Biden and the FDA and the NIH and the CDC and all these people. If you're buddies with those people, you can say whatever you want. And if you're doing it in the form of a vaccine, it doesn't matter how many people you harm. You're protected from any criminal action. You're protected not only from negligence, but you're protected now from fraud, intentional fraud, according to these people. And if they're not protected legally, they're protected by the press. They're protected by the government, even if they don't have a legal exemption against deliberate fraud. They are protected by the government and by the press from these types of things. But, you know, as I said, this is the most deadly plague that humanity has ever faced, because humanity has never done anything this over the top, has it? So therefore, this has got to be the most deadly plague. And yet, if it is something that is simply, that is scientifically proven to be susceptible to a nasal spray that is essentially saline, that's the main ingredient. It's saline, grapefruit seed extract, and xylitol. It isn't the ingredients, it's the flushing that is significant. Just cleaning out your nose. That's really the essential thing. And if we were to say this is something that is easily remedied with zinc and some other supplements, or is easily remedied with, you name it, you know, a nose flush, then why are we locking down the entire world? And why is everybody getting vaccinated when that is the only thing that is allowed for people? As a matter of fact, the lawyer hit it on the nose. He said, rather than embrace nasal interventions, the government is trying to eliminate their use because they don't fit the government's highly flawed vaccine-only agenda. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, probably, same thing that I'm thinking, Pinky, that they're trying to take over the world. if they can shut everything down, and if they can, how about this? How about if a nose flush works, and they call it a hypertonic nasal saline irrigation, which I think just simply means that you're flushing it under pressure, for the most part. I mean, there may be something else involved in that specific term of hypertonic, but if a nose flush, cleaning out your nose, has some big effects on this in terms of reducing symptoms and reducing people getting sicker. Do you think that if you were going to do one of these tests, which everything is predicated on the test, if you can get one of these PCR tests on somebody and you can magnify it by 1.1 trillion times, which is way, way, way beyond what the inventor, Kary Mullis, who got a Nobel Prize, said was ludicrous. So if you can take this up to ludicrous speed, and you can label people as sick even though they have no symptoms, and you can lock the world down because you claim that there's a pandemic, you wouldn't want people flushing out their noses. As a matter of fact, you might want to give them a nasal test that uses swabs that aren't the usual cotton swabs that we've always used. It's got little spikes in it. They leave it behind, as we've seen when people rub those things across a piece of meat. Could that perhaps make things worse? Could it make things better if you did a nasal flush? Is there anything particular about grapefruit seed extract that is so wonderful? It's mainly just the flushing and the saline, I think. But the lawyer defending this says, rather than embrace nasal interventions, the government is trying to eliminate their use because they don't fit the government's highly flawed vaccine-only agenda. The vaccine-only agenda. But it's also the Great Reset agenda, locking everything down, destroying people's lives. So here are some of the tests that they did. On September 20, 2020, the NIH published the findings of a random clinical trial that they funded at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee on the merits of using hypertonic nasal saline irrigations to combat the CCP virus. So what they said was, before we had this vaccine, on September the 20th, the NIH did a study with Vanderbilt, and they found that this nasal flush was very effective. So we made a product of nasal flush, and now you're telling us you want to bankrupt us? And you want to prohibit us from selling this? See how that works? Why? Vaccines only. The effect, quote, in the study, said, quote, the effect of nasal irrigation on symptom resolution was substantial. Nasal congestion and headaches in COVID patients resolved an average 7 to 9 days earlier in the study group. Now, that's much better results, by the way, than remdesivir, which is very expensive and very deadly. Our analysis suggests that nasal irrigations may shorten symptom duration and may have potential as a widely available and inexpensive, see, that's the problem, inexpensive intervention to reduce disease burden among those afflicted. We would advocate the use of hypertonic nasal saline irrigations in non-hospitalized COVID-19 patients as a safe, inexpensive intervention to reduce symptom burden, said the study, the Vanderbilt University study, funded by the NIH in September of 2020. So now the same government is punishing people who came up with a nasal saline solution. They pointed out that it was also a clinical trial a few months later, November, at a hospital in Florida, the Larkin Community Hospital in Florida. They found that this particular nasal spray that these people put together, so then that was just in general a saline solution that was tested by Vanderbilt. Then these people put together one, the X-Clear company, or X-Lear, X-L-E-A-R. They put together their nasal spray, and they took it to a community hospital. And they found that it cleared the symptoms of the disease in half the time. Half the time. So in addition to the Tennessee and Florida trials, they had another random clinical trial conducted at Augusta University's emergency department in Georgia, also concluded the same thing. So obviously, these people have to be shut down. And anybody who opposes the vaccine narrative needs to be shut down. It is absolutely criminal to oppose what the establishment wants. So we had Albert Bourla, the CEO of Pfizer, at the Atlantic Council. These people, the Atlantic Council, in case you don't know, closely tied to NATO and the intelligence agencies, always pushing war intervention and behind this agenda that is rolling out. So they did a very long interview, but there was a couple of nuggets that came out of this. And the key one being what you're going to hear right now, with Bourla saying that anybody who opposes this is criminal and should be treated as such. And he had the CIA and the FBI helping him with this as well.
There was some fake news during this period of time about the vaccines, you know, all sorts of conspiracy theories. How did you deal with that, and how did you navigate that, and where do you feel the primary source of this sort of fake news was? How damaging was this to us?
I'm afraid it was quite a lot damaging, and there was particularly with us, we were targeted by a lot of let's say dark organizations that you don't really know the ownership. You suspect that there are some countries behind.
He's not dark.
We're getting a lot of briefings from.
He doesn't have any alliances with companies or intelligence agencies.
Attacks that may happen to us, cyber attacks, I mean, but also about the spread of misinformation.
You know, getting intelligence
there
briefing.
There are two groups of people, right? There are the people that they are vaccinated, there are people that they're skeptical about the vaccination, and both of them are afraid. Those that they're getting the vaccine,
we've made sure they're afraid
of the disease, and they believe that because people are not getting vaccinated, they are increasing the risk to them. They are increasing the exposure. So they are, let's say, mad with them that they don't get the vaccine. Those that they don't get the vaccine, they're afraid of the vaccine. And they are met with the people that are pressing them to get it.
And
there is those I understand. Yeah. They are very good people. They are decent people. But they have a fear And I understand it. And they don't want to take chances. But there is a very small part of professionals which they circulate on purpose misinformation so that they will mislead those that they have concerned. Those people are criminals. They're not bad people. They're criminals because
he's projecting, isn't he?
They costed millions of lives.
And then should be treated as criminals as well.
So just chill out. You know, drink a 7-Up, eat a moon pie, quit murdering people.
Yeah, maybe he could quit murdering people, you know? You want to talk about somebody involved in criminal misinformation? And I apologize, I talked over it a little bit when he said, I was contacted by the CIA and the FBI, and they gave us intelligence about how we were going to be attacked. Oh, I mean, you know, cyber attacks and things like that. These people are just criminal who are putting out misinformation. They're killing people. He is literally killing people for money. This guy has become a multi-billionaire with the money that was given to him with Trump's Operation Warp Speed and with the sales that they have. Their sales are, vaccines alone, are four times what all of their sales were. And oh, by the way, this isn't the first time Pfizer has been involved in criminal activity, just like Johnson & Johnson and their opioid epidemic. They all get away with it. These guys, they don't even need to have legal immunity. I mean, Johnson & Johnson and the Sackler family and Purdue Pharmaceuticals, and Johnson & Johnson was a key supplier to the Sackler family. They got away with that opioid epidemic. They didn't have a Fauci rule that said they had legal immunity. They were given that legal immunity by the government that won't prosecute them, by the government that won't penalize them, by the government that won't stop them, just like they won't stop these pharmaceutical executives like Albert Bourla. He is a criminal. He is a murderer. He has blood on his hands, and he's projecting this onto other people. I tweeted that out yesterday. And I said, this is psychological projection. Taking what you are and projecting it onto other people. And I quoted Revelation as well. You know, the sorcerers, the pharmakia. You know, these people who do not repent of their murders. That's exactly what he is. His number was up. He was pointed out over 2,000 years ago. And you may run on for a long time, but sooner or later, God's going to cut you down. He had your number 2,000 years ago, Bourla. So they don't want anything that's going to reduce the symptoms, even of this. Get rid of the symptoms. Do it in half the time. See, this would destroy the vaccine. This would destroy the vaccine narrative. It would destroy the panic pandemic narrative, and it would also, I think, make people start to question what all this nasal treatment is about. As I mentioned several months ago, I had a friend who said, yeah, I've got a couple of elderly relatives, and they were very, very paranoid and did everything that they were told. They stayed isolated because, you know, they're watching mainstream media news. And the two of them, a couple, and the husband got sick with something else that was not COVID-related. And he went to the hospital, and they tested him. He tested negative, and they did it again and again and again. They did it four times over a short period of time. They really wanted that result. And they know that, you know, if you magnify it that much, you know, you're going to get lucky. Maybe you can win, you know, $13,000 and a 20% bonus on everything that you do. But they did it. They never did get a positive on him, so they weren't able to shove him in a corner and kill him. But what they did do was to get his nose irritated and infected. Maybe it's better to do a nasal spray and to get this stuff out of there. As Information Liberation points out, yeah, he's shielded from all liability, and now it is a crime to even speak about what he does. The Pfizer CEO. CNBC gave the highlights. People who spread misinformation on COVID-19 vaccines are criminals, said Bourla. And since he's now the government, I guess that is, I mean, we don't have to have laws or rules. These people make the rules and the government officials follow them, whether it's Trump or Biden or anybody that is lower down. They all just do whatever the pharmaceutical people say to do. Bourla said they're criminals because they have literally cost millions of lives. He said life for many people can go back to normal once many of the unvaccinated people get vaccinated. You see, He's nothing other than a blackmailing thug. This is the same kind of blackmail on an individual basis that they were doing in late 2020 to nations. Argentina, Brazil, a third Latin American country, being blackmailed, saying, you're not going to go back to normal. Nobody's going to go in or out of your nations without our product. And so we're not going to give you our product unless you not only give us the kind of liability that Fauci gave us back in 1986, but we want liability protection against deliberate fraud and against all manufacturing errors as well. And oh, by the way, we also want you to set up bank accounts and foreign assets outside of your country so that, you know, in case there's somebody who's honest there and actually comes after them, they can get to those assets in foreign countries. That's what they were demanding. And they were demanding that of European countries as well. We now know that from the documents that have been leaked. And, I showed you the clip from the members of the European Parliament saying, what is this? These are the documents we had to sue them to get this. And when they gave it to us, they're all redacted. Everything is blacked out on here. There's no transparency about what our governments and what the European Union has agreed to do with Pfizer. So he has not only blacked out the agreements and prohibited even our elected representatives from seeing what those agreements are, but he's saying if you speak out against him, that you're a criminal. I'm not hiding anything. Borla is hiding things. Borla is blacking this out. Borla is blackmailing entire countries. You want to look at what happened with Israel. They sold out their people as lab rats, said, we'll give you all the data for 2 years on them, but you put us at the front of the list. Since we had bet on Moderna, we thought they were going to be first, but you've got better manufacturing facilities, so you're going to beat them to the punch. So we want to be put at the front of the list, and they were. And in exchange, they promised that they would give every kind of data to Pfizer so they could look at it. Why? Because nobody had done any tests on this. And so they partnered with him. They use Israeli people as lab rats, this corrupt Israeli government. So this is nothing but a mafia protection racket. And it's being run by this thing that you saw here was the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council and NATO has been at the forefront, folks, and I reported on this years ago when this was all starting to roll out in 2018. The Atlantic Council was one of the main organizations pushing the censorship of speech more than 3 years ago. We've got to take these people off of social media. We have to shut down news organizations if they don't agree with us and so forth. That was coming out of the Atlantic Council, these people allied with NATO and the surveillance state. And now this is what they've got Borla saying. And I'm sure this is agreed to. Oh, yeah, let's push this censorship angle again for both of our sakes. Those people are criminals, he said. They're not just bad people. They're criminals because they've literally cost millions of lives. And the only thing that stands between the new way of life and the current way of life is, frankly, hesitancy to vaccinations, he said. Now, think about that. We got a new way. We got a new normal. You don't like being locked up under house arrest. You don't like being banned from all activities. That's especially effective with the kids in schools, isn't it? You'll have no activities. You'll play no sports. You'll have no future unless you get the vaccine. And then I promise, this Faustian bargain, I promise you'll have all that. I'll give you all these things that you see everywhere in the world. Just bow down to me. Take my injection. So, yeah, they're given total liability protection, foreign bank accounts and other places, but we are the criminals. We're the criminals. So as you look at this, even the LA Times says a study shows dramatic decline in effectiveness of all three of the COVID vaccines over time. Or maybe they were just lying from the start. Would that be the case? The Atlantic, not necessarily directly connected to the Atlantic Council, their headline, their article, pushing the fact, this is the headline, unvaccinated people belong on the no-fly list. As Chris Minahan, Information Liberation, says, we're ruled by absolute criminals. That's right. The FBI, CIA, they're in contact with this criminal CEO of Pfizer, Alex Borla. And then when CNBC reports this, their angle is to say that, oh, he's absolutely right, of course. They said there was a study that was published by the Kaiser Family Foundation. How do they benefit from this, the Kaiser Family Foundation? Again, they're all partners in crime. The Kaiser Family Foundation said that more than three-quarters of U.S. adults either believe that they or aren't sure about at least one of eight false statements about COVID or the vaccines, and unvaccinated adults. Republicans are most likely to hold these misconceptions, these people who are the final arbiters of all things true and false. Among the falsehoods are that COVID vaccines contain microchips, or that they cause infertility, or that they change one's DNA. Now, in this interview with the Atlantic Council, the CEO of Pfizer talks about how his mRNA can change DNA and how that's a really good thing. Listen to this.
What other doors might this mRNA vaccine open?
And there is a third application, please, which is for people that they are born with a mistake in their DNA code. And there are a lot of rare diseases that they are happening to people because somewhere in one gene there is one small mistake in their DNA. And those people are, you know, they have to live with that until the end of their lives. And many times their life doesn't last very long because of this mistake in their genes. There are a lot of technologies that are trying to use gene editing, so that they are trying to use same technology to be able to change, repair the mistake of your DNA so that you can cure basically those people.
Yeah, okay. So we can repair, we can do gene editing with mRNA. Now, when we would push back against this and we would say, you're altering our DNA. Oh, no, mRNA, it can't modify DNA. It just copies it. Well, if it makes an error, and if the way this thing is set up, if it's programmed to make errors, it's going to change things. And we had Thomas Jefferson University, not funded by the government, but just doing a very elegant and simple experiment. They said, oh, by the way, yes, you can modify DNA using mRNA. And now you've had the Pfizer CEO himself say that it's not a bug, it's a feature that they tend to exploit in the future. That they will edit people who have a disease that is because of a mistake in their DNA code, and we'll fix that mistake for them and charge them accordingly. They're going to give him, the Atlantic Council today, they're going to give Bourla a, quote, distinguished leadership award today. That's how this works out. So going back to the nasal spray, the Justice Department completely ignored the Vanderbilt study. They ignored the Larkin study. They ignored the one in Augusta, Georgia. And so that's exactly what you would expect from them, isn't it? We have a letter here. I've got a letter here from a listener. And he says, I work in a printing plant. We have about 60 employees running three shifts. He said 12 of us caught COVID within the same week. And here are the stats that he put together. So that's about 20% of the business within 1 week, excuse me, contracted COVID. He said the age ranges were between 30 and 50 years old. 9 out of the 12 who got sick were fully vaccinated. Everybody experienced the same mild symptoms. Half had a slight fever. I had no fever. Sinus congestion and pressure. excuse me. Fatigue, loss of taste and smell. The most serious case was a 50-year-old who was fully vaccinated and had an autoimmune disorder along with some other health issues. He experienced all the above symptoms along with chest congestion, but he still recovered. He was the only one who had chest congestion. Everybody recovered within 7 to 10 days, and everyone was back in the office the day after testing negative. Everybody is still experiencing a slight loss of taste and smell, which is annoying. So you can see why if you got one-fifth of the audience gets it, and they send everybody home, and 9 out of the 12 people, in other words, 75% of them who got sick were fully vaccinated. He said, I was the oddball. I started taking ivermectin, vitamin D, A, C, quercetin, and aspirin. I thought I would recover the fastest because of the ivermectin, but I was actually the last to return to work after 12 days. My question is, and I didn't contact him back to ask this, he doesn't list zinc. Now, I don't know if he took zinc or not, but the purpose of ivermectin and quercetin, as well as hydroxychloroquine, all three of those are ionophores. And so the purpose is that they are, what they are is essentially a catalyst. Zinc is the key thing. You know, taking them along with zinc is the key thing because they make zinc more available to your body. They open it up. It's kind of a catalyst. So I don't know if he took that or not. But anyway, he said, I was actually the last one to return to work after 12 days. What's strange is that even though I took a longer time to test negative, I believe my symptoms were the mildest out of everybody, possibly because of the ivermectin. But my recovery was a full 3 to 4 days longer than the rest. Even though I was feeling better by 9, I was still testing positive until day 12. Your guess is as good as mine. My medical friend said it was probably because the COVID entered through my sinuses, which means that I was testing the injection site, which will yield positive results longer. But who knows? It's maybe new nasal saline flush. Anyway, for the most part, there was no difference in symptoms or longevity between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. The other two unvaccinated employees returned to work on day 8. There were no serious complications, and everybody described their experiences exactly the same. The only thing I can conclude from this is that the vaccines simply don't work. We all got it. As a matter of fact, 75% of the people who got it were vaccinated, so it didn't do anything to transmission. We all got it. We experienced similar symptoms, and we had similar recovery times. It was probably a blessing in disguise for me because I went a full 14 days without coffee or cigarettes. I got the best sleep of my life. I no longer have bags under my eyes, and my lungs are clear. Now I'm fully sober, fully vaccinated, with the real deal. He's got antibodies. Thanks, Fauci, he says sarcastically. I feel great. Look great. Well, I'm glad that you recovered, and thank you for that detailed report. This individual says, I'm a doctor, and I fear we will never regain the public's trust again after COVID. He says, think back to where this was. You know, we've had since 2020. We've had President Trump's chief medical advisor, Fauci. We also had his surgeon general, the guy who basically was appointed because he was friends with Pence, Jerome Adams, right? Remember that? Remember Jerome Adams? They were both telling everybody, don't wear a mask. And then, you know, within a few weeks, they were telling you must wear a mask. It became mask tyrants. This is the Trump administration, by the way. It's a bipartisan issue here. The COVID vaccines were declared to be effective at preventing the spread of disease until breakthrough cases around the globe proved that wasn't so. And the effectiveness was then downgraded to, well, it protects maybe against some deaths. Both The Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine, two of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, have issued embarrassing retractions to widely publicized papers. By the way, New England Journal of Medicine has, in my opinion, completely destroyed beyond all hope their credibility. They've been involved in politics more than anything else. They've been involved in psychology, war gaming, how they were going to roll out the mandates. They have a vaccine-only policy. They're completely in bed with all of this. And as a matter of fact, the chief editor at the New England Journal of Medicine was one of the people on the scientific committee that approved this for kids. And he said, well, really, the only way we're going to know how to do this is if it's safe or not is just to give it to everybody. So they're not about medicine. They're completely ignoring their first do no harm medical ethics that was about it. And they were the ones who were wargaming from the very beginning. We don't want to do this through government mandate. We want to do it through corporate coercion because we don't want people coming up with due process challenges. And that's what these people are really concerned about. So this physician who was writing this op-ed piece says, even medical terms such as herd immunity and the word vaccine itself have literally been redefined over the last few months. All of this has shocked a great number of informed, educated people around the world. But should it? If we look back briefly at the history of science, we see that scientists are many times completely and utterly wrong, and in retrospect, often comically so. That is the norm, not the aberration. They're constantly changing where they are. And as I've said many times, when I was simply talking about climate change, I said, they're using their title. They're using consensus in the medical community. They're using the fact that they are at a prestigious university or publication or they work for the government. They're using that as evidence that they're right. But those kinds of people have always been wrong. Scientific advance has always come when you got the lone guy who's challenging the consensus. I use the example of the Wright brothers versus Langley. Langley was the most respected scientist of his time. He was the Dr. Fauci of his time. They named the Langley Air Force Base after him, and that area there where the CIA is headquartered. He was head of the Smithsonian, and he was trying to get a flying machine. He couldn't do it. Why? Because he wanted to believe, and he would not question, the established lift tables. The Wright brothers, on the other hand, were a couple of homeschooled bicycle mechanics who decided they would come up with their own tables based on their own research and their own observations about the way birds flew. And they were able to get something that flew when Langley couldn't. It's more than a gut feeling rather than based on reality, on really truly serious data, said Dr. Patrick Moore. The data itself is not strong, but it's kind of heading in the right direction. That's the guy from the University of Pittsburgh. And again, that is... You know, talk about a gut feeling. I get a gut feeling when I read what the University of Pittsburgh is doing to human babies with Planned Parenthood and the NIH, Fauci's NIH. Makes me want to throw up. And so this guy is saying, well, yeah, let's approve this for kids after they've been chopping babies up for fresh organs, not frozen, fresh. And then this physician goes back and talks about climate data and all of that. I won't go into every bit of it because I've talked about this so many times. All the false predictions going back 50 years about how man-made climate change will wreak untold havoc. It was all about their agenda. Gender theory, as he points out, that relegates chromosomal and biological reality to an incidental genetic quirk that can be corrected by hormone therapy and surgery. All of this has an agenda attached to it, and they want to sweep science away. He said scientific inquiry is definitely limited to the present and to the material. And he points out anytime somebody wants to talk to you about assertions about what happened in the past, the distant past, or in the future, and they want to shout everybody else out of the room, just ignore them. Just ignore them. They're not talking about science. He said, and secondly, to physicians, researchers, and scientific and medical community at large, approach your roles with some humility. You do no one any favor, yourselves most of all, when you overstep the bounds of experimental knowledge and you adopt the roles of priests, prophets, and oracles. And when you start to act like dictators, this is the key. This is why you have Scott Gottlieb worried about this. This guy's pointing out, hey, look, we've never lost so much credibility so quickly, and rightfully so, in both the pharmaceutical and medical industries and what the hospitals are doing to people. And this is why Gottlieb is worried that maybe this is going to have some blowback, and it could. And it absolutely should.
Well, the public health implications I worry about is that the opposition that's forming to these COVID mandates is going to bleed into opposition to other kinds of vaccine mandates and things that we've long come to accept, like mandates on childhood immunizations for school, even mandates on healthcare workers. People are going to start to oppose. They're not going to parse opposition to mandates on this COVID vaccine to mandates to other kinds of vaccines. And you're going to see vaccine uptake generally start to decline. That's what I worry about. And I think from a public policy standpoint, we need to ask ourselves, what is our goal? Mm-hmm. We vaccinated about 81% of adults over the age of 18. Where do we need to get to, and what price are we willing to pay in terms of cultural divide, acrimony, challenges, and also the creation of things like exemptions? So a lot of businesses right now are creating exemptions as a way out of these mandates, and that creates problems for the future as well.
Yeah, we don't want people having exemptions from our products. I mean, we worked very hard to get Trump to help, you know, decide with California and New York and say the kids have just got to get the vaccines. We're going to take away your religious exemptions. We're going to take away your medical exemptions. We don't want those things coming back. You know, we might want to just look at, we got like 80% of the people. Maybe, in the words of Kenny Rogers, maybe we need to know when to hold them and when to fold them, when to walk away, and when we better start running from the crowd when they find out what we've actually done to them. And as we're talking about how the medical community has lost all credibility, frankly, this was sent to me by another listener, BJ. He said, this is a local story. And he goes, they don't really touch on the bigger picture. And you got this clip, Travis. Let's run that.
Hospital staff to care for your mom while she's struggling to survive COVID, only to find her in disturbing conditions, including maggots in her nose.
The children have photos to prove it. They shared their heartbreaking story with Orange County reporter Jessica DeNova.
This family says lack of medical care by staff at South Coast Global Medical Center in Santa Ana led to their mother's death.
I ran around so much for my mother and to try to save her.
Carolina Mijango says she and her siblings did all they could to help the nurses here treating their mother as she battled COVID-19 in the summer of 2020, taking turns bringing meals, making friends with the staff.
It felt like a betrayal to that trust because they kept telling me, she's okay, she's going to be okay. We're giving her the utmost care.
Finally, at the end of July, Concepcion Covarrubias tested negative for COVID-19. Her children asked to move the 65-year-old to a rehab center, but say their request was denied. In the weeks that followed, Mijango says her mother's infection levels rose. Her children say the conditions of their mother's makeshift room were unacceptable.
That to me was not acceptable. Not in America. Not this kind of hospitals.
Then during this visit from Concepcion's son and daughter, Manuel Mijango knew his mother was in pain.
She was crying, and she was going through a lot of pain. And I told my sister, my mom is not okay at all.
A devastating discovery caught in this video call. Concepcion's son's reaction seen here when he found maggots in his mother's nose and mouth.
Maggots pumping out of the nose.
Concepcion's children are suing, alleging elder abuse, negligence, and wrongful death. A spokesperson says the hospital is not commenting while litigation is pending. According to the complaint filed in court, nurse notes state two or possibly three dozen maggots started coming out of the patient's right nares. Concepcion passed away a few days later on August 21st. Her children say their mother was well-loved by everyone, always caring, supporting others, not deserving of this.
I wouldn't want anybody else to go through the same thing, to be such strong advocates, and at the end to feel so betrayed.
Both parties are scheduled to meet back in court in January.
All right, let's recap what actually happened with this. 65-year-old woman, she tests positive for COVID. And then she basically gets over it, tests negative, and the family wants to move her to rehab. Hospital doesn't want to let her go. Now, they're not going to tell you in that report why. I'm telling you why. They got their $13,000 bonus, but they also get a 20% bonus on everything that they do. And this was in July of 2020. It's now become standard procedure for them to push the family away, not even let them see the patient, because, you know, if it's such severe neglect that the patient's nose and mouth is filled with 2 to 3 dozen maggots, that gets the family very upset, as you just saw, and rightfully so. They have been able in this criminal, this medically subsidized, financially subsidized medical malpractice that has come out of this so-called emergency and the money that was released as part of Trump's program here. This is what that has produced. These people who can keep your family away, they can take a situation that basically is not all that serious. As I point out many times, you know, George Washington got a cold from riding around his estate on a horse on a cold, wet day. And then the doctors came in and started, and they removed, I forget what large percentage of his blood started giving him mercury and a bunch of other things, and the doctors killed him. Medical malpractice, one of the leading causes of death, and has now been financially incentivized. These people have an excuse to keep family away so they're not able to see what is actually being done to them. We'll be right back. Stay with us. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.
Hear news now at APSRadioNews.com or get the APS Radio app and never miss another story.
All right. I want to take a look at the mandated Trump juice for a moment. We have, as we look at the effects of these mandates, more than half of the U.S. Border Patrol agents could be fired for being unvaccinated. Do you think that this is a plan? Do you think they're surprised about this? According to an internal report from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which was leaked, they say that more than 10,000 will be gone. That'll leave about 8,000. Per the document, 48% of agents have not registered the vaccination status. Of the 52% who have done so, 10% have registered as unvaccinated. Under the scenario that they're looking at, they think they may lose 60% of Border Patrol, more than 10,000 people. We also have Navy SEALs who are suing the Biden administration. And I like what the lawyer points out here for First Liberty Institute. This is over the rejection of religious exemptions for Navy SEALs, even. Dozens of Navy SEALs, along with other Navy service members, have joined in a lawsuit against the Department of Defense that has refused to grant anyone a vaccine exemption. The lawyer said, quote, "The fact that the government has not granted a single religious exemption from the vaccine mandate shows that the Biden administration does not care about religious freedom." This is the general counsel for First Liberty Institute. He said, and this is the key, "Instead, this appears to be an attempted ideological purge." Oh, that's exactly what it is. And I've said that for a long time. They want to get people who have integrity. They want to get people who have religious beliefs. And quite frankly, they want to get people out of the military, out of the police, who are skeptical about the narrative that's being sold to people about this being safe and effective, because they want to use the police and the military that are behind against those of us who are unvaccinated. That's exactly what this is. This is not only an ideological purge to try to remove people who have Christian principles, but this is also a political purge to come after people. Each of their religious exemption denials appear to be identical, said the lawyer, suggesting that the Navy is not even taking the requests seriously. You know, if you use a form letter, then they'll say, well, you're just using the same letter. We're just going to throw that out. But then, of course, they use a form letter to deny your sincerely held religious exemptions. He goes on to say, the Navy also warned some of the plaintiffs that if they sought a religious exemption, the Navy would confiscate their special warfare devices, such as the famous SEAL trident that they proudly wear on their uniforms, The vaccine mandate substantially burdens the SEAL's free exercise of religion. And the Department of Defense has failed to prove that it has a compelling government interest or that there are no less restrictive ways to further the effort to mitigate the virus. One former Navy SEAL said, "We generally have about 2,500 Navy SEALs. It takes a lot of time to get to a certain level, but hundreds of them are leaving because of this nonsense." So we have the Border Patrol being kicked out. We have the military. We have the SEALs even being kicked out. We have Navy pilots and Army pilots that are being kicked out, people that they've invested a lot of time and money into supporting them. But they are going to be kicked out if they have any religious concerns about this. A labor union that is representing the TSA, even the TSA, is concerned about this. TSA and other federal workers the union that has about 700,000 government employees asked the White House yesterday to give workers until at least January the 4th, which is what they extended the deadline for the presumed power to tell private businesses what they have to do, and the intimidation that they're putting on federal contractors, they extended both of those to January the 4th, but they're not doing that for the people who are direct federal workers. They are going to have a deadline that is just before Thanksgiving. Naturally immune employees are suing Fauci over the vaccine mandate, some of the federal employees. One of the people representing employees in one of the lawsuits said this: "If your federal employer can do this to you, can they also impose liposuction for the overweight? Or can they take spare kidneys for other workers who are in need?" Well, that's a good point. I like that analogy. Because, you know, we're talking about your health doesn't matter, right? See, your mask, we know that it doesn't protect you. Your mask protects somebody else, and their mask protects you. I mean, we even had the public service announcement that was on YouTube saying, you know, my mask protects this person. That person says, and my mask protects that person. And they, you know, show all these different people, two different genders, a lot of different skin colors and ethnicities. And they all had the same mantra, you know, my mask protects that next person and that next person and that next person. So, you know, we could use the same thing. We could say, you know, and of course they use that for the vaccines as well. Now this stuff protects you. So, you know, if your kidneys are protecting you, that's not good enough. Maybe, you know, your kidney should protect somebody else. So let's just remove it. Except they won't do these kidney transplants, even when you've got a donor, as we saw, specifically saying, I will donate my kidney to my friend. Met this person in a Bible study, and after about 9 months said, well, I'll give you the kidney if we're a match. And they were a match, but then the hospital said, we're not going to do any transplants. She wasn't jumping ahead of anybody in line. There's nobody in line. This was specifically somebody who was going to donate her kidney to her friend. And so we're not going to do it unless both of you are vaccinated. Neither one of them was going to get vaccinated. So they let her die in the name of public health, of course. So maybe, you know, your government can take a spare kidney for somebody else who needs it. Maybe. The fact that the mandate does not grant exemptions for both natural immunity and for fully remote workers calls into question whether it is designed to accomplish a legitimate federal purpose. By the way, the natural immunity thing is not there, but fully remote workers, that is in the order for 100 companies, companies that have 100 employees or more. They now have put that in. I put that out as a special, as a cut when I talked about it on Monday after we saw the regulations. It's on page 63 of the 490-page document. You will see there that if you are a remote worker, you are not subject to these vaccine mandates. Furthermore, if you work on the outside, and I think they put this, and many people have said they put this in as an exemption to make sure that we don't do any more damage to the trucking industry. Who knows? I kind of think the Biden administration is trying to do as much damage as it can. But maybe some of the people who were negotiating this at OMB with the corporations, maybe they did that to help the trucking industry, because maybe the trucking industry is with friends with somebody. Maybe they got a temporary reprieve on that. But the bottom line is, if you're a long-haul trucker and you're not involved, you're operating in a cab by yourself, you don't have to get this either. And so they put that in there, as well as the escape clause with the testing, so that if you are a remote worker, or you're somebody who works outside of the office and doesn't come in contact with any of them, like a trucker, you do not have to get the vaccine. If you were to go to the office, you've got to get a test 72 hours ahead of time, according to these new rules. But those rules are not the same as the rules for the people who are federal employees or for people in the military. In other words, they don't have equal protection under the law. That's another issue. And we know that transmission is a non-issue, because we've heard from one person after the other. As a matter of fact, we got Bill Gates now saying it, so I guess you can believe it, because he's the world's most important doctor, right? We've had Walensky at the CDC. We've had The Lancet in the UK. We've had Boris Johnson. We've had politicians. We've had the medical dictators, these institutions that are calling the shots. Even our Lord and Master, Bill Gates, of all of the global government, they've all said that these vaccines have nothing to do with transmission. And so why are we doing this in the name of public health? There is no justification for any of that. But they have now put in an exemption for some people. Again, it's all just willy-nilly. A former health advisor to the federal government, Dr. Paul Elias Alexander, has teamed up with Dr. Harvey Risch of the Yale School of Medicine and with others to compile a list of 106 studies indicating natural immunity to COVID-19. I gave you that reference a couple of days ago, produced by the Brownstone Institute. 106 studies talking about natural immunity. And again, the bottom line is, the purpose of a vaccine is to train your immune system. If this were a working vaccine, it would be training your immune system. But of course, your immune system can also be trained by actually having the full disease. That's just the way that it works. Top NIH scientist opposes the vaccine mandate, and we'll have a live debate on the ethics of all of this next month. Scientist is Dr. Matthew Mamoli. He runs the clinical studies unit under Fauci. He opposes both vaccine mandates and has declined the vaccine himself, arguing that the jabs should be reserved for the vulnerable, the elderly, and obese Americans. He has served at the agency for 16 years, and he recently received an NIH Director's Award. And he even pushed back against the mandates in an email to Dr. Fauci. He wrote to Fauci and he said, "I think the way we are using the vaccines is wrong." That was back on July 30th. He argued that blanket vaccination of people who have low risk of severe illness could hamper the development of more robust immunity gained across the population from infections. It's not that he's just making this stuff up. At least one major study conducted by Israel showed that immunity produced by natural infection is more effective and longer lasting than the vaccine-induced immunity, if such a thing actually exists. There's a lot of debate within the NIH about whether a vaccine mandate is appropriate, said David Windler, a senior NIH bioethicist who is in charge of planning the session. He says this is an important hot topic and we need to talk about this. Current data shows that within the NIH itself, 10% of the people are not vaccinated. Inside Fauci's NIH. This is why, when pressed by a couple of senators, Burr and another individual, you know, she was asked a question by another senator. She refused to answer how many people at the CDC were vaccinated. Walensky did. And so Burr pressed her on this. And then he pressed her on the idea, do you have any plans about what you're going to do about people who don't do that? Well, we haven't done it yet. We're thinking about maybe checking to see who's vaccinated or whatever. She just blew him off. Wouldn't commit to even firing people at the CDC who don't get the shot. I mean, the CDC has been about vaccinations, flu vaccinations, and everything else forever. COVID boosters are likely to be annual, says the Australian Pharmacists Guild. Oh, you think? They said The only question is whether it'll be every 6 months, every 9 months, or every 12 months. That's exactly what they wanted to do. And of course, that is the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. At Fox News and at Newsmax dossier, at Substack, the people at they publish at Substack.com, dossier says Fox News and Newsmax are two-faced. They're going above and beyond the Biden vaccine rules. They have punitive policies for unvaccinated employees. And so they've created an incredibly punitive and coercive work environment for unvaccinated employees. And we have seen the one reporter for Newsmax saying, I'm not going to do this. I will never subject myself to this. And so now they have gotten some inside people to talk to those people at the dossier. They said on October the 15th, Fox established their daily testing program. It forces non-compliant employees to undergo a nasal swab every time they show up to work. And then, listen to this, they have to wait outside until the tests come back negative. And that means that these people have to come to work much earlier than their vaccinated colleagues do, while being just as likely to spread the virus that causes COVID-19. They do not have to do the daily testing requirements. So the people who are vaccinated, it has absolutely nothing to do with transmission. They don't have to get tested on a daily basis. They don't have to come to work early in order to get tested for this. Internal documents show that both Newsmax and Fox News are running a relentless coercion campaign to pressure employees into taking the shots while setting up discriminatory structures for those who choose not to show proof of having complied. Failure to comply will result in discriminatory sanctions such as having to wear a mask in the office when the vaccinated employees do not need to, and the COVID test nonsense I just talked about. Fox's Human Resources Department has been sending a bombardment of emails to unvaccinated employees that the dossier got a hold of. One of the things that they sent said, please keep in mind that if you become fully vaccinated, you will no longer be required to participate in daily COVID testing. So in other words, they put this out there. It's a gradual iterative process, isn't it? You know, first they get the people who think, who really believe this and are very much afraid. And they eagerly snap this up. And then the people who are a little bit more reluctant, they then offer them a lot of carrots and rewards if they get it. And then they come up with some punishments. And they offer people a little bit of a choice there. And then they get it a little bit harder. And then after a while, instead of, you know, offering you some carrots and some sticks, both of these two things, then after a while, you either get the prick or you get the stick. That's what we should call it. Instead of a trick or treat, we call it prick or stick, or stick or prick. I don't know. That's what this policy has become. You know, we're either going to beat you with a stick or you're going to get the prick. And so, yeah, this is what is. I was looking to see if I had on the board here. I don't. The meme that was done by a listener had Fauci holding up a hypodermic needle and said, expect a little prick soon. accommodating the Biden OSHA rule through weekly COVID testing regime at both of these places, Newsmax sent out an email to all of its staff telling them they will be implementing the OSHA rule starting December the 5th, even earlier. To ensure that we're in compliance, we require that all vaccinated employees submit a copy of their vaccination card by December the 3rd, says the email. And then, as I think I pointed this out, I'm not sure if I pointed this out, this is a statement after they had the pushback from one of the broadcasters saying, I'm not going to do this. I refuse to do this. If they force this, I'm leaving. And so they talk about the fact that testing will be provided at Newsmax's offices at no charge. See, isn't that nice? I said that when I talked about the revised rules, the way the corporations had negotiated this. They said, this is going to be very expensive for us to provide all these tests for everybody. So we want you to allow us to charge them for tests. We don't have to, but we want you to allow us to charge them. And I said, this is going to be used by these corporations to say, aren't we nice? We pay for the test. And that's exactly what Newsweek did within a couple of days. We will make the test. We'll provide the test at no charge to you. Isn't that nice? And beginning December the 5th, employees who are not vaccinated will be wearing masks and doing tests all the time. But that's okay because we'll pay for the test. CNN, after airing that town hall with the Sesame Street puppets, absolutely reprehensible. One of the things I didn't talk about that I think was very significant was the fact that that CNN town hall came just hours after the FDA approved the vaccine, where the scientific community says, well, we don't have the numbers, but they seem to be looking good. You know, let's go with it. I've got a good feeling. I've got a gut feeling. Another one said, well, we aren't ever going to know until we give it to everybody. So roll up your sleeve and get the Trump aids. Get the Kool-Aid or the Trump aid. The show told kids that they could have play dates that they weren't able to have unless they get the vaccine. See how this works? Isn't that reprehensible? I think that's just disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. So, you know, so does Ted Cruz. He thinks this is disgusting. He blasts this as government propaganda, which it is. Question is, will Ted Cruz do anything about it? You know, we got government propaganda coming out of Newsmax and Fox. The reason they're doing all this stuff, folks, is because they're funded by, that's what they didn't say there. And the disruptors, or not disruptors, the dossier, they did not say, they did not point out that these organizations are funded by big pharmaceutical companies, especially Fox. They're just propagandists for them. And so is CNN. And Ted Cruz rightfully calls that out. But the reality is, Vaccine Impact points out, the reality is that we've got a lot of Republicans, we've got a lot of red state governors who were supplying this bioweapon that we call a vaccine. This bioweapon is being supplied by red state governors for parents to abuse and to attempt to murder their children. I agree with that headline. I endorse that 100%. And it points out that, you know, we've got people like Texas Governor Abbott, people like Florida Governor Rick DeSantis. They say, well, we're opposed to the mandate, but hey, we'll help you to vaccinate your kids, right? Texas began injecting kids on November the 4th. And in Florida, they began injecting kids on November the 6th. See, all these things are stockpiled. They don't run a test. They don't do any testing to see if they're safe or effective for kids. We know they're not needed. We know the kids don't have any risk. But nevertheless, they made 28 million of these things for very young kids all the way down to 5. Biden put those together. He sent those out to these red state governors who say that they're against the mandates, but they're not against the vaccines. They're telling everybody they're good. They're good. You should have them. And here, we got them for the parents if you want to do this. So we got a lot of parents who are worried about the next step, and we know what the next step is, right? Being forced to do this. We've already had some kids who have been given this accidentally. We've had some people who have had their kids injected by people who do not respect parental rights. And so they're concerned that their kids are going to be forced to do it. Rolling out 28 million of these. Again, it is an iterative process. You know, you got the incentives first. Then it's like, well, you know, you're going to have nothing at all in your life if you don't do this. But if you do it, we'll give you back your, you know, the ability to do things that we took away from you arbitrarily. See, I robbed you of all this stuff, but little Jimmy, and I'll give it back to you. Just give me all the money in your wallet, and I'll give you back the thing I just stole from you. How about that? That's what this really is. And then you get the prick or stick treatment coming up after that. Ted Cruz has introduced a bill to ban schools and the federal government from forcing COVID vaccines on kids. Well, finally, he does something, right? I'm glad he's doing that. It's too little, and it's a bit too late, quite frankly, but we'll take whatever we can get from these people. I doubt that this bill will go anywhere. It will not be signed by Biden if it were to pass, but you know it's not going to pass in the House under Pelosi. So your protection is not going to be coming from Washington at all. It's going to be coming from the lesser magistrate, and it'll be coming from you by getting your kids out of the schools in the first place. So he says, my view on COVID vaccine has remained clear. No mandates of any kind, but they're good, you know. So, you know, if you want it for your kids, we got it here for you for free. I'm not going to force you to take it. You know, I want your consent. They always want your consent, don't they? While cases of severe harm reported to the Federal Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, says LifeSite News, are less than 1%. Remember that back in 2010, the HHS itself said that fewer than 1% of vaccine adverse events are reported to the system anyway. So let's take a quick look at headline news here. We have, as we're talking about Ron DeSantis, we have he is essentially attacked by a local TV news reporter for CBS down in West Palm Beach. This guy thinks he's got some gotcha questions for Ron DeSantis on the Let's Go Brandon. This is what they're focused on. And so I want you to hear how DeSantis handled him.
Last week, you called the Biden administration the Brandon administration. Do you feel that that is the proper level of exchange between a governor and
Shame
a president?
On you.
Well, let me ask you how he's treated us. I mean, you know,
shouldn't you rise above that?
Well,
even
they
if
take
he
a lot of pot shots. But look, I think it's a joke. But honestly, one of the reasons why that is taken on is because a lot of your folks in the national media, they get very sensitive to it. Because what happened was, people were chanting something else very colorful.
It's a swear about the president.
Well, you had a reporter, though, say that it was Let's Go Brandon, when that's not really what was said. And so I think the reason why it's caught on is because I think it needles the national media a little bit. Because, look, I mean, they've become very partisan. I mean, you know, they were very much against Trump. They're very much ahead of Biden. So I think we view it as fun. But I do think
But it's
that,
a swear but about I do, the president.
Well, right. But, I mean, here's what I would say. Was there hand-wringing about this, about the stuff that was said about Trump for 4 years? No, there wasn't.
That guy is so smarmy. I mean, he's just, it's a smear. You know, he's got this smirk on his face like Jacinda Ardern does when she talks to people. Yep, that's exactly what it is. We're going to take away everything from you. His name was Jay O'Brien, and he's trying to make his move to move up to the big time and to become a national figure for CBS News. And you heard what DeSantis said, and he's exactly right. That is a taunt, not just of Biden, but that's a taunt of the media. And that's what Jay O'Brien didn't really understand. This is really, DeSantis was polite. He said, you know, it's about these people in the national media. No, it's about you, Jay O'Brien. It's about people like you. You'll do anything to cover up whatever Biden is doing. And so it was making fun of you as much as it was making fun of Biden, perhaps more about making fun of you, actually, or people like the NASCAR president, Steve Phelps, who is very, very upset about the fact that this is being done. He really does hate his fans. You know, he banned the Confederate flags that they had out there and all the rest of this stuff and a lot of other things. You know, by the way, you know, NASCAR has become this big corporate entity. It was so much better when it was small, when you had people like Jimmy Johnson who had learned to drive by running cars, bootlegging whiskey and stuff like that. When you look at the early days of the Daytona 500, one of the first places where they had these kinds of organized races. I mean, go back, look on YouTube and see some pictures of the Daytona 500 when, you know, Daytona Beach, the sand is very packed. And from the, you know, the type of sand that's there is a little bit different. And as the tide goes there, it packs it pretty hard. We lived in Florida. We lived in Texas, Tampa, when I was growing up. And we would drive over to Daytona Beach quite a bit and then drive up and down the beach. About 3 years ago, I went with Karen, my wife, and yeah, you basically can't go up and down the beach anymore, not in front of the boardwalk. There's some other places where you can do it, and then they charge you a large amount of money. It was like $10 or something, and they have a little limited area there where you can get on the beach. And it's like, I'm not even going to bother with this. But back in the day, they had these cars, and of course, they just looked like they were stock cars. They had done a few things to them, but they were basically just stock. And they would have one leg of it that was down the hard-packed sand. And then they would have a return leg that was up on the highway. So they just closed off the highway. But the interesting part of the race happened when they made the turns, because in that transition between the packed sand that was out there on the beach and the road that was up on top, it was very soft sand where the water did not, you know, pack it down. And they would bog down, they would slide in that. It was very entertaining to watch. I mean, that kind of simple thing. And I mention all of that as a side story simply because, you know, a lot of the things that are being shut down to us and taken away from us are things that have been monopolized by these big corporations, these globalist corporations or these Wall Street corporations. They've basically taken the life out of everything. They've taken the fun out of everything. You know, we can start to go back and do some of these things ourselves, and it'd be a lot better. A lot better than NASCAR, for example. Just start your own races somewhere. At a football game, they had a Let's Go Brandon banner flying across a football game in Missouri. I'm sorry, it was over Athens, Georgia. And it was a football game between Georgia and Missouri. And this is put out by Getter.com at the end of it. A BBC journalist writing for, well, being interviewed by RT, had this to say about the state of media. And we all know this, but it's good to hear what somebody who pointed this out back in 2007 said. His name is Robin Aitken. He said there's an acceptable and polite view of the world events, which is dominated by media liberals. You see, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to shut down even something like Let's Go Brandon. That's hate speech or something, right? It's not polite. You're being impolite to the left. And so he says, it's media liberals who are saying you have to be polite. You must not oppose or mock us. We don't like that. He said, you got a media culture in Britain, but this extends into other countries all over the West, where there is an acceptable and polite view of world events that is dominated by the media liberals. He says, when it came to Trump, there was unanimity in Britain's mainstream media that Trump was bad and a bad man, and they were going to wish him into the cornfield. He doesn't use that analogy from the Twilight Zone, but that's basically it. Or you had people who were on the right who were going to tell you that he was another George Washington, right? And it was all 4D chess. He left the British public broadcaster, BBC, in 2007. He warned that we should all be, quote, skeptical of the hidden persuaders that operate in the media. He noted that the uninitiated or those who are unfamiliar about the way media works should be aware that news bias is about the selection of stories that you carry even more than their specific content. Let me just say that again. There is bias inherent in the stories that you carry and not just about their content. And I have used this analogy over and over again. I used that analogy even before Matt Drudge flipped. I said, look at this. Matt Drudge doesn't write anything. He links to other organizations. In many cases, he was linking to even when he was conservative, his aggregation was conservative. He would link to the New York Times and the Washington Post and things like that. But the stories that he would pick, even coming from those people, would show a conservative bent. Everybody knew it, whether you were left or right. You knew that was where Matt Drudge was. And that's why it was so startling when he went the other direction. And so now he's doing just the opposite thing. But he doesn't write stories. He's essentially selecting which stories he's going to present to you. See, I do that as well. I'm not just an aggregator, though. I also analyze the stories. I tell you why I think what I think. But I've always understood this. Going back to when I was in college, I would look at Newsweek and I'd look at Time Magazine, and they would be exactly the same. You know, and they did have a very statist orientation. But, you know, I could look at, for example, I've used this analogy many times, National Review versus The Nation, right? National Review being conservative, The Nation being very, very liberal. They were upfront about the fact that they were opinion journals. Time and Newsweek tried to pretend that they were objective. They weren't objective. They weren't objective at all. Not in their content and not in the stories that they chose to report. They were not objective any more than ABC, CBS, and NBC were objective, or PBS was objective. And not just in their content, in the stories that they chose to talk about. And so I liked to have people who were upfront about where they're coming from and say, here's the news, here's what I think about this and why I think about this, and let them essentially have a debate with each other. And so that's really what how you need to consume news. You need to understand that, you know, whether you agree with me or not, I'm going to tell you why I think a particular thing. And you can take a look at it, and you can agree with my opinions or not. I will give you my opinions. I'll tell you why they are my opinions. But I'm not going to present myself as being some objective source. Anybody that tells you that is lying to you or lying to themselves. If they really do think that their political opinions or their worldview, whether they're Christian or atheist or whatever, if they really do think that their worldview does not come into effect, they're idiots. They're idiots and shouldn't be listening to them. If they understand that and they're telling you that they're totally objective, then they're deceiving you and you shouldn't listen to them either. I think you ought to just pay attention to people who are upfront about where they're coming from. But that's what they're continually pushing back against. They like to pretend that they are objective, even though they're giving you an opinion that is filled with a perspective. And they want to say that that perspective is objective and everybody else is misinformation or disinformation. And now we've gone to the point where you've got the pharmaceutical murderers calling everybody else murderers and saying that we're criminals and we need to be locked up. Marjorie Taylor Greene is looking at people who are locked up as prisoners of war. She says this is like walking into a prisoner of war camp. She and Louis Gohmert went to the D.C. jail. Earlier in the day, they went to the mayor's office, Muriel Bowser. They delivered a letter demanding that they have access to the so-called Patriot wing of the jail there, arguing that it was their duty as congressional members to oversee how the city spends its taxpayer dollars, because it is the District of Columbia. It's carved out specifically for the government, the federal government, to control. The federal government is not allowed to own the vast amounts of land that it owns. It was allowed under the Constitution to own and control the District of Columbia and some forts and some ports, but not the vast swaths of land that it now owns. But getting back to the story, Marjorie Taylor Greene on Twitter said, "I've never seen human suffering like I witnessed last night." She said when she walked into that wing of the jail, she was, quote, greeted by men with overwhelming cheers who rushed out to meet me with tears streaming down their faces. She described them as forgotten and hopeless. It was like I was walking into a prisoner of war camp and seeing men whose eyes can't believe that someone had made it to see them. They're suffering greatly. She said virtually no medical care, very poor food quality, and being put through re-education, which most of them are rejecting. She said, "I am committed to ending the political war, this political war, and seeing that our justice system is never used against Americans as a political weapon ever again." Well, she's exactly right. That's exactly what is happening. She said, we have to begin a plan for real prison reform. As a matter of fact, there was just an article that came out recently. I haven't covered it, but it was by John Kiriakou, talking about how now some more details, have been released about the torturing that was done to political prisoners under Gina Haspel. She was the one who covered that up. She destroyed all the video records of that. John Kiriakou was the one who exposed it, and for exposing the torture, the criminal torture, the unethical, illegal torture, the torture that produced the intelligence that was the basis of the lies for the weapons of mass destruction that lied us into the Iraq War. For covering that up, she was rewarded by Trump as being made the head of the CIA. But more information has come out about that. But these are American citizens. Any government that can do that abroad and get away with it will eventually do it to the people that are their political enemies here at home. And that's what we're seeing now. Because nothing was ever done about that. Because the people who did the torture that lied us into the Iraq War got away with it. Every single one of them. The only person who went to prison was the one who exposed the crimes that they'd committed. All the criminals went free. You have psychological contractors who schooled the CIA on ways to torture people. They got tens of millions of dollars. And the lawsuit against them was shut down. All of these avenues of reform and of redressing these criminal practices, all that was shut down. And again, Trump rewarded that. He rewarded that. But the bigger issue is the fact that they are being kept in pretrial detention. We're now going on to about 11 months. Julie Kelly, who's done some investigative reporting on this, said that despite the repeated claims that January the 6th was an armed insurrection of white supremacists, not one person has been charged with carrying or using a firearm inside the Capitol building. It's a total fraud. We understand it's a total fraud. As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting that one person was able to escape. He's now on the U.S. Most Wanted list, 48-year-old man from California, Evan Newman, is currently seeking political asylum in Belarus. And he's on the FBI's Most Wanted list, but he's being hailed as a hero in Belarus. Because, you know, he's pushed back against a government that, you know, there's no love lost between the ex-Soviet Republic of Belarus and the U.S. So he pushed a barricade into officers, they said, and punched multiple officers before asking, "I'm willing to die, are you?" And the person who is giving him sanctuary there, essentially, is described in this story by Zero Hedge as Europe's last dictator. They featured the story as an example of Western hypocrisy and America's crackdown on human rights. That's the way it's being portrayed in Belarus. They said that this guy first flew to Italy, then he took a train to Switzerland, then he drove to Ukraine, then he crossed the border illegally through a swamp into Belarus. And now, you know, he's, in other words, went to a state that does not have extradition treaty with the United States, that is basically on unfriendly terms with the United States. As they describe this guy who is running the place as Europe's last dictator, I'd say what we're seeing now is the beginning of America's dictatorship. You know, we have, they're just the old-fashioned dictatorship. But, you know, we have the new kind of dictatorship. You know, the one that's built on an emergency.
Emergency! Everybody to get from street! Emergency! Everybody to get from street!
Хорошо!
Yeah, that was sent to me by a listener. Thank you for sending that clip. That's from BJ. He says, yeah, you want to talk about it being an emergency? That's exactly what it is. That's from the movie, The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming. And by the way, the Russians are already here. The Russians, the globalists, the Marxists, if you will, they have shut down our country. It began with the emergency. Emergency, emergency. Everyone to get from cities and to get from businesses. And you wait and we inject. Yeah, the medical emergency to create a Stalinist dictatorship. Imagine that. I mean, you don't even have to have a situation where you got some guys who are stranded in a Russian submarine landing and everybody think that they've been invaded by the Russians. No, we have been invaded by the commies. We've been invaded by the commies and they are setting everything up. They said the way they're portraying him in Belarus, they say that Newman is the same type of simple American whose shops were burned by Black Lives Matter activists. Oh, and they had their shops shut down by Trump as well. However, something makes him flee from the country of fabulous freedoms and opportunities, as we used to believe. Emergency, emergency. He must get from cities. He sought justice, and he asked uncomfortable questions after Biden was declared a victor over Trump, but he lost almost everything and is being persecuted by the U.S. government. On his behalf, Newman said, "I do not believe that I have committed any crimes. One of the charges was very offensive. It alleged that I hit a police officer. There's no reason for this charge. This is terrible. This is political persecution, and this is a level with which I cannot do anything." In the interview, he tells a reporter from Belarus, he says, I'm just an average American fleeing political persecutions. Should he be allowed to stay in Belarus under asylum or protected status? It's unlikely that the FBI or the Department of Justice can do anything about it, since there is no extradition and there is no love lost between the two countries. As we look at the history of corruption and the removal of any due diligence or testing for these vaccines or for any of these other treatments, as a matter of fact, remdesivir or any of these others, this type of corruption is a little bit more easily recognized, I think, for most people. If you talk about, as one whistleblower has come forward, the tests that were being done on steel, those are going to be used for U.S. Navy subs. And the fact that it was falsified for decades. A former metallurgist at a Washington State foundry that produced steel used in U.S. Navy subs has admitted to taking shortcuts and doctoring the results of strength and toughness tests on the metal for over three decades. According to the Justice Department, the tests were to prove that the steel would hold up in a collision or during certain wartime scenarios. While there was no information on whether any submarine hulls had failed, authorities said the Navy had incurred additional costs and maintenance-related expenses to go back and to ensure that the vessels were seaworthy. The person involved in this, Thomas, told the court that she faked test results for at least 240 steel productions between 1985 and 2017, 32 years. Roughly half the steel the foundry supplied to the Navy. Her attorney said that she took shortcuts, but she never intended to compromise the integrity of any material. Unlike, you know, big pharmaceutical companies that do that deliberately. House Democrats have blocked consideration of a bill to prevent taxpayers from paying $450,000 to illegal immigrants. Now, just take a look at this. As we've talked about this over the last couple of weeks, first, it was released by some people in the Biden administration that they had negotiated with the lawyers for some of these people who had recklessly endangered their children, violated the law by dragging them over a very dangerous area filled with cartels and traffickers. And then when they arrived to protect the welfare of the children, they were separated for a while. You know, there's never been any consideration in terms of people who have had American citizens who have unjustly had their children seized by Child Protective Services, CPS. And this has happened over and over again. I've talked to Dwight Mitchell, many other people. Dwight Mitchell, middle class father, black father. He says it's more, this is happening more to the black community and minority communities because they figure that they're not going to have the resources to fight this. But he said, after he saw what happened, and he thought it was just an aberration. He thought it was just him. And then he realized it was a very large program that was several billion dollars are being spent on this to do this across the United States. So he began an organization to help to educate people. And it is, let's see, what was the name of his organization? I'm trying to remember the name of his organization. Maybe, do you remember, Travis? If you do, just jump in and say if you can look it up.
Stop CPS Legally Kidnapping Children.
Yeah, Stop CPS Legally Kidnapping Children. And he has another one that he set up, and it's all instructional videos telling you, don't assume, because you're not guilty of anything, that you need to open up your house and let these people come in. They will use that against you. You know, you rigorously stand up for your rights as if you were guilty, because these people don't have any mercy. So this is happening to people all across this country, to Americans, and there was never any sympathy for them by these people on the left. There was only sympathy for people who had actually endangered their children and violated the border law. Now, as they were negotiating this with lawyers, the lawyers were pushing for like $3.5 million per parent. And the Biden administration was reported to have agreed to a settlement of $450,000. So I was talking about it. I said, yeah, who wants to be a millionaire? You know, just drag your kids across a dangerous crossing where a lot of people have died or been kidnapped. And so when asked about it, you remember Joe Biden said, well, that's a bunch of garbage. That's a bunch of garbage. He was gone when that story broke. And when he comes back from his vacation, his climate vacation, he says, that's nothing but garbage. And then the White House itself came back and said, no, actually, we are going to do something, but I can't tell you what the number is. I won't tell you. I don't know what the number is. I know nothing, right? And so this is now the tack that's being taken by Biden as well. And so the Republicans call their bluff on it. And the Republicans said, we've got a bill here which would stop $450,000 payments to these people. And the Democrats blocked that. The bill would have prevented taxpayers from paying $450,000 to each parent who dragged their kids, these illegal aliens who dragged their kids across the border and endangered them. Instead of solving the Biden border crisis, Democrats want to literally pay people to break our laws, said Kevin McCarthy. Well, he's right about that, and they're doing that to expose the hypocrisy and the agenda of Biden at the border. Obama, while he went to this climate conference, he gave a speech. And just like Wolf Blitzer was confused, he thought he was at the conference. So I don't know where he was. Like I said, I don't know. He might have been back in the U.S. pretending that he was at the conference, and they had the wrong backdrop. They had Edinburgh, Scotland, instead of Glasgow, Scotland, where the conference was. So it's like, but you can believe everything he has to say, right? Even though he doesn't even know what town the thing is in. And he's not telling you where he is. I seriously doubt that any of that was real, because they're not going to fly to Edinburgh. Instead, they would just basically put up the wrong backdrop. So Obama gets up and makes a speech where he calls Scotland the Emerald Isle. That's Ireland. And then he talks about, well, since we're in the Emerald Isles here, let me quote the bard William Shakespeare, who is English, by all accounts. By the way, you know, it's a very interesting book. I'd highly recommend that, by Joe Sobrin, called Alias Shakespeare. I read that decades ago. But it's very interesting. Now, even though I'm not necessarily all about Shakespeare, it was kind of a mystery. And Joe Sobrin, who he used to be the editor of National Review, he got pushed out by William F. Buckley, but he used to be the editor of National Review. And he was I think he's an English major or something, but he knew quite a bit about Shakespeare. He said, there's one thing for certain. Anybody who really studies Shakespeare, they can't agree as to who Shakespeare was. But people who are Shakespeare scholars are pretty universal in disbelieving that it was a guy from Stratford-upon-Avon whose name was actually William Shakespeare, not Shakespeare. Most people believe that it was somebody based on the writings, based on the things that happened. And it was very interesting because Sobrin went through the life of the person that he and many others believe that it is. And not, again, not everybody agrees on this, but a lot of them believe that it was the Duke of Oxford, Edward de Vere, whose life paralleled many of the incidents, the stories that were there, and being kidnapped at some of the places that he traveled to and being kidnapped. And he points out that this guy out of Stratford-upon-Avon was kind of a middle-class guy. If you look at the Shakespeare stories, what is the perspective that they're done from? It's done from the perspective of somebody that's a part of the court. It's not done from the perspective of somebody who's in the middle class watching this stuff. This is all court intrigue, things that are happening there. And so he made the case that it was not him, but made a very good case that it was Edward de Vere. He even had a group that paralleled some of the titles and some of the other things that were part of Shakespeare's life. And he pointed out that, you know, why would he do that? Well, in that day and time, it was considered, really, if you were upper class and part of the court, you did not want to be associated with the theater. It was considered to be a very low-class thing, which now we know is actually true. Why do we look up to these people in Hollywood? I mean, they're some of the most degenerate, drug-addicted, narcissistic people, vacuous. I mean, why do we treat them like royalty? I don't know. But, you know, he actually was royalty, and he had some interesting things to say. I enjoyed it because of the story in it, not because it was necessarily because I'm a big fan of Shakespeare, so to speak. He did give us a lot of our language, though. Melania Trump, however, is a big fan of the log cabin Republicans. And, you know, you hear all the time about the Lincoln Project, right? This is the radical LGBT mob that came after Trump. They didn't come after Trump because he's anti-LGBT or any of that agenda at all. No, they just didn't like him. And it's people like Kellyanne Conway's husband and others. Most of the other people who were in it were very radical LGBT mob. As a matter of fact, I can't remember her name. One of the co-founders, female, was in New Hampshire. And she left the Republican Party because she wanted the Republican Party to sign up to punish people if they didn't use the right pronouns and if they didn't worship at the altar of the LGBT. So they're not about having a place at the table and you know, being allowed to do things. They demand that you celebrate them. They demand that you worship them, essentially. And that's the kind of person that she was. And so that's the radical branch. The Lincoln Project, the Log Cabin Republicans, it's a homosexual group that has been a part of the Republican Party. And this was the Spirit of Lincoln Award that they were handing out there in Mar-a-Lago to Melania Trump. This is not the first time that the Trumps have embraced and celebrated this. And that's the key. You know, I'm not looking to punish anybody for what they do. I certainly don't believe that's the role of the government to do that. But I refuse to celebrate this. I refuse to celebrate sin. I refuse to celebrate what Trump has done, even in his life. I mean, you go back and you look at the movie that came out directed at him for the way that he had treated his first wife, Ivanka. It's called The First Wives Club. Everybody was outraged at that time about Trump because of the public way that he not only cheated on his wife, broken his marriage vows, but taunted her publicly with his new girlfriend before he married her. And so they actually did a movie about that, First Wives Club, back in the late 80s. So, you know, he's somebody who's always celebrated sin, not just homosexual sin. But he and Melania have celebrated the Log Cabin Republicans, Richard Grenell, a political appointee that is appointed. You know, he doesn't celebrate it in the way that Biden does by putting in people like Levin, you know, that guy that he's made an admiral of. You know, Biden does it in a more in-your-face way. But that's where Trump is as well. That's one of the other things that I don't understand about the evangelical love affair with Donald Trump. Over the years, the Log Cabin GOP and Richard Grenell have been pivotal in uniting people, taking a stand against bullies and labels, wrote Melania. Bully, see? You celebrate these people, or you're a bully. You celebrate these people, or you should be kicked off of social media. Kyle Rittenhouse, of course, I haven't talked about this, but what is interesting about this is not just that he is being unjustly targeted for political purposes, but I think it's even more interesting to see the way this is being reported now after this whole thing blew up in their face. And I didn't go into this the beginning of the week, but, you know, the very fact that the defense attorney and kind of a Perry Mason moment got the guy who was the key witness for the prosecution to admit that he was not shot in the arm until, you know, he was pointing the gun at Kyle Rittenhouse, that it was a loaded gun. And at first he denied it. And then the lawyer says, well, here's the picture of it. And he goes, as the moment that you're being shot in the arm, it's being blown away, you're pointing the gun at him, and you were coming at him with a loaded gun. Yeah, oh, yeah, that's right, I did. And you see the picture of the prosecuting attorney. It's just like Perry Mason with his face face in his hands, like, oh, no. And yet, even with all that happening, here's the key thing. First of all, they're not dropping the case. That's pretty key. Secondly, you have some of these BLM people who are bragging about the fact that they are photographing jurors in order to intimidate the jurors, saying that they're going to dox them. You have a judge who realizes that, but isn't declaring a mistrial. He's been approached by the defense attorney to say, you know, this is it. You need to dismiss this. They don't have a case anymore. It's not just that guy. You know, it's other evidence that's come out that shows that Rittenhouse was operating in self-defense. But then look at what the media did. Again, the media. The Associated Press refers to this guy who was the aggressor as a shooting victim who was pointing his gun at Rittenhouse. This is the headline. Shooting victim says he was pointing his gun at Rittenhouse. He's not a shooting victim if he's pointing a gun at somebody. He's not a shooting victim. You don't point a gun. Let's go back and talk about this Alec Baldwin thing again, maybe, right? You don't point a gun at anybody that you don't intend to shoot. And in a situation like that, what was happening where Kyle Rittenhouse, that was very clear when he's pointing a gun in that kind of environment that he's planning on shooting him. So this guy was this is the way the Associated Press does it. The third and final man gunned down by Rittenhouse during the night of turbulent racial justice protests in the summer of 2020. So Kyle Rittenhouse is a guy who is going out and gunning people down over racial issues, according to the Associated Propaganda people. Unbelievable, isn't it? He took the stand at Rittenhouse's murder trial, and he recounted how he drew his pistol after the bloodshed started. Meanwhile, CNBC is referring to him as a Rittenhouse survivor. Headline, Rittenhouse survivor testifies in the murder trial. Now, this guy, Grosskreutz, I guess is how you pronounce his name. I haven't been following it in terms of watching the video, so I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his name. Let's say Grosskreutz literally changed the story under oath and went from denying that he was pointing his gun directly at Rittenhouse before getting shot to admitting it under, as he was confronted with the picture. And it's like, now remember, you're under oath. you could get charged with perjury. So I'll show you the picture again. And so then he tells the truth. He is a hardcore leftist with a criminal history, writes Information Liberation. He's also admitted under oath that Rittenhouse was, quote, in physical danger, unquote, after he was attacked by Anthony Huber, who also has a long criminal history. That took place just seconds before Grosskreutz aimed his gun at Rittenhouse and got shot. He's literally trying to become a multimillionaire off of this incident. Nevertheless, according to the media, he is a, quote, victim, a, quote, volunteer medic, and, quote, a Rittenhouse survivor. Survivor. Absolutely amazing. And so what is also equally amazing is the way the judge is acting. After being told that jury members were being filmed. As a matter of fact, I briefly mentioned the fact that you had a guy on social media bragging about the fact that he was filming jurors, threatening them, intimidating them, tampering with the jury, saying that he was going to dox these people. And for that reason alone, if this judge had any integrity, he would declare a mistrial, and he would declare that there is absolutely no proof that Rittenhouse did anything wrong. And then that way, you wouldn't have to worry about the jury. But then that way, he would be the point man. He would be the one that they want to come after. And I think it's to save his own skin that he is not doing this. Judge Bruce Schroeder denies defense motion to reconsider the request to dismiss the count six, the possession of a dangerous weapon by a minor. He also informs the attorneys that a deputy observed someone taking video of the jury as they arrived. The deputy made the person delete the video. The judge said, quote, I've been assured the officers had the video that was taken deleted, but new measures are being taken to make sure that that does not reoccur. And then even on Facebook, they're still purging anybody who says anything that defends Rittenhouse or that says that he's not guilty of mass murder. They declare that they will shut that down, and that's exactly what they're going to do. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we have Tony Arterburn, who is going to be joining us with wisewolf.gold, and we're going to talk a little bit about gold and about cryptocurrency because I haven't mentioned it as much, but, inflation and what is happening in our country, I mean, we are looking at a possible very devastating hyperinflation. And this is going to rob the middle class and Americans of any remaining wealth they have after the lockdown, the destruction of Main Street businesses, and the removal of jobs. Now they're coming after your money with hyperinflation. So how do you defend this? We're going to take a look a little bit at some of the ways that you can get started, some of the precautions and safe practices that you need to do if you want to try to diversify the money that you have into some crypto or into some gold. We'll be right back with Tony Arterburn.
common man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at the...
If you like the Eagles,
on a dark desert highway,
the Cars, and Huey Lewis in the News,
they say the hotter rock and roll is competing.
You'll love the Classic Hits channel at APS Radio. Download our app or listen now at APSradio.com.
All right, and joining us now is Tony Arterman, and Tony's been a frequent guest of ours. He's hosted for me many times in the past, and he also has wisewolf.gold, and he sells gold, silver, and he also does crypto. So yesterday we were talking to GoatTree about crypto, and you know, there's been a lot of moves in the last couple of days. Tony, thank you for joining us, by the way.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. And by the way, just want to underscore that the domain name is .gold. That's kind of unusual. I didn't know that there was a .gold that was out there, and a lot of people may not understand that. So I just want to clarify that with them. So it's wisewolf.gold, right?
That's right. Oh, I have several domains. You can go to wisewolfgoldandsilverbranson.com or wisewolfgoldandsilver.com. It pretty much takes you to the same place.
Good, good. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this because, you know, we've got over the last few weeks, we've seen a lot of moves in terms of, well, there's been some implied threats in terms of, well, we need to have more reporting. But for the most part, they've been allowing new exchanges and new ways for people to essentially to gamble on this stuff, as opposed to just holding it as a hedge for inflation. But we've had people like Tim Cook come out and say, yeah, I have crypto. You've got other billionaires who are coming out and saying the same type of thing. So there's a lot of moves that are being made by people like this, as well as we have PayPal is now accepting cryptocurrency payment. MasterCard, after doing a deal with the UN in terms of talking about how they were going to start monitoring people's carbon footprint, they're now saying that they're going to allow people to use cryptocurrency with the MasterCard in Europe. And we've got the Zimbabwe government considering adopting Bitcoin as legal tender. And as you know, Zimbabwe has always been synonymous with hyperinflation, and that's really my concern in all this. I'm not somebody who likes to invest in a stock market because I see it as kind of a casino. But the reality is that we're kind of holding a casino-like asset when we hold Federal Reserve paper money. And we're looking at something that could very likely turn into the kind of hyperinflation that Zimbabwe is famous for. Now they're turning to Bitcoin as a possible legal tender.
Yeah, a full circle.
Yeah.
Right? the trillion dollar notes from Zimbabwe. Now a full circle. I'm cautiously optimistic about the crypto space. And I've talked about this before on your show when I've hosted, but I got into Bitcoin in 2016. I saw a Bitcoin ATM and I saw people were just going and putting money in. And I thought, I'd read about Bitcoin. I knew it in Reason Magazine. I'd followed kind of the rise of Bitcoin as somebody who's libertarian leaning and not a fan of fiat. So I jumped in with both feet. I was like, I'm going to buy an ATM. I'm going to figure this thing out. And, you know, Bitcoin's been real good to me. I was able to launch Wise Wolf because of it. It's helped me with my income. So I'm really grateful to whoever or whatever Satoshi Nakamoto is. But I look at this space and I know, you know, people are getting excited about crypto, and you should be, because I think it gives us an opportunity to be sovereign, to trade with ourselves. We don't need the government, by the way, for money. I mean, we have That's gold, right. We have silver, we have a worldwide standard for those metals. So you really don't need them. What you need them for is for payment processing and distance. Like if I want to send you, like I send you Bitcoin sometimes, I'll just go scan at my ATM. I'll scan your wallet ID, send it direct to your account. And I don't have to put that in the mail. I don't have to go through a bank. That's the brilliance of crypto. The problem that I'm seeing is that the powers that be, that the Federal Reserve bankster class have printed so much, right? 40% of all the dollars ever created made last year. Like, who knew you could create hyperinflation with printing more than you've ever printed and then shutting down and nuking small business and having a lockdown economy? Who knew, right, that the supply chain would cause that? Right. So they've printed this massive amount of money, and it's devaluing our dollar while we have the lockdown economy, while there's problems with the supply chain. So this is coming to a head, right? Kind of a perfect storm. Then I look over and I see, and again, it's, I'm not talking bad, but there's certain meme coins. You got to be very careful. There's these giant parabolic rises in crypto now. And so everybody thinks if I put my money in, I'm going to be a millionaire, right? I'm going to make this massive amount of return. I think that's what the powers that be are focusing on, right? You know, China got rid of their mining just altogether. You know, their plan was to adopt the digital yuan. They did. They got rid of their Bitcoin mining, get out. You know, they'd had those issues before where they've told people that they to stop and then they let them do it again. And this, I think, is permanent this time.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the world, especially the West, looking for the central bank digital currencies to come out, and they haven't quite made that move. And I'm worried that if, you know, I want people to learn crypto, but be careful of how you proceed, because it looks to me like they're going to cause, and I know that they've done this before. If you go back the history of the Federal Reserve, you know, this is the 1907 crash was the incident that led to the Federal Reserve. And of course they caused the Great Depression. They're always intervening. They need a fall guy. They need a patsy. And I think that crypto could be the patsy for them to usher in the new digital currency. So this is what I'm doing on my shows. I'm cautioning people. I'm telling them to be careful. Learn it, though. You know, I'm setting up my shop as a kind of a white glove bricks and mortar exchange. That's what I'm going to be doing very soon, so I can teach people. Like, you want to come in, set up an appointment, I can teach you how to set up a digital wallet, you know, how to buy and sell cryptocurrency safely.
Great. That's a really good thing. Yeah. That's great.
That's something I had. It takes a while. You have to put a lot of stuff in place now with the regulations. So I kind of leaned on my machines, but I'm going to do a more of a bricks and mortar, you know, feel for the exchange and help people set up their wallets, because education is key. Mm-hmm. You know, because you have this certain demographic that hasn't learned to set up their crypto or use cryptocurrency, look at it skeptically, and I understand. But that's my caution, and I have a chance to tell anybody. You know, and I just picked up a show. I've got a Wise Wolf Gold and Crypto show on Aftermath.fm. They picked me up on Tuesday nights. So we're actually on the same network. So I wanted to give a big shout out to Aftermath.fm. Good people over there.
Yes.
But yeah, we're going to be talking about that. And I know you wanted to discuss some practical ways that you can learn about crypto. And I've certainly can set people on the path to that.
Yeah,
and
let's talk about that a little bit. But I want to touch on something that you just mentioned. And that is, and that's something that's always been in the back of my mind about Bitcoin, how it is being allowed at this point in time, I think, to condition people. But that doesn't mean that you can't cautiously use it and use this to hedge against hyperinflation and some other things. You know, when we go back and we look at the internet, I think, Tony, you know, we had a very free and open situation for, you know, about 20 years or so as the as people started getting used to the internet, everything was wide open. Everything was free. Social media was the same way. And yet I think they always had from the very beginning a design that after they got people channeled into a few places, and I think that's what we're going to see now with this stage of the internet, as Gautree was saying yesterday. He thinks this is like the fourth stage of the internet, of you know, the information society, whatever. You know, you had the liftoff stage, where things were put together really with a personal computer. And then you had the next stage where they start bringing in the different websites and so forth, the social media. This is the fourth stage, and that is the cryptocurrency. And I think just like we saw with these other stages of the internet, they lure people in, come on in, everything is free. Then they shut the gates after they've established a leader, and after they got everybody packed into Facebook and YouTube and Twitter. I think the same thing is going to happen. They're going to pack people into certain cryptocurrencies, and they're going to pack people into certain exchanges, and then they will use those as a means to control people. I think that's ultimately where this is going. But I think we're in still kind of in the liftoff stage where they're holding back. And it's still, I think, a bit of an opportunity, especially for people if you're concerned about hyperinflation. And I think many of us need to be concerned about that. It is another way that you can try to hedge against that.
Yeah, I think that the plan has always been to get people to use it and adopt it. But the Bitcoin is really a variable because it's not centrally controlled by anyone or a country or a mm-hmm. company. It is the way it was launched. It had to be launched the way it was for it to work the way it's working right now. So it's really it's either the greatest thing ever, right, or it's totally disastrous. I'm leaning towards it's great, and that's just from years of experience and looking at it. So
I'm not saying that they're necessarily going to use Bitcoin that way. I'm saying that they're going to normalize people using electronic payments and things like that.
Right.
And then what they'll do is they'll shut down Bitcoin, let's say, and Ethereum, and tell everybody, oh, now you got to use our central bank digital cash. I think that's, in my opinion, that's what they're going to do. But I think it's good to have that. It's going to be difficult for them to do it. But I don't think they're going to try to do it right away. And that's the key thing. I think we do have a window here. And so we need to take advantage of this and learn something about this. So tell us a little bit about what you would tell. Just give us a little. I know there's a lot that we, more than we can really cover here, but just give people a general idea of how they might get started in terms of getting into cryptocurrency and some of the precautions that they need to take in case they're a total newbie.
Well, I would recommend a couple of different ways. One, you need to look at setting up your own wallet. And a digital wallet is something like an Exodus wallet. You can type in Exodus. That's what I use. It's a wallet not tied to an exchange. The second thing you're going to want to do when you download your wallet is write down the phrase. There's a 12-word phrase usually that'll back up your wallet. So if you drop your device or if it burns out or if you get a virus or something and you lose your wallet and you can't open up your device again, you can reinitiate it. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. And of course, you need to write that down in the physical third dimensional world and laminate it and put it in a fire safe so you don't ever lose that, because that means that your crypto's gone at that point.
That's right. And so you can never get that back.
Right. You can never get that back. And there's a few exchanges out there. Obviously, places like me, are going to be bricks and mortar. You can walk in. There's Bitcoin ATMs. There's some safe ones that, if you want to call me and ask me about where my location, we've got 12 Bitcoin ATMs kind of spread over Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri. And, if you're trading with someone safe, then you'll be able to buy and sell safely. And I would just say, look at getting a wallet set up first. Have a wallet that's not tied to an exchange. Mm-hmm. You're going to want two. You're probably going to want something linked to like a Coinbase or a Gemini so you can buy and sell safely. Like if you want to link your bank account to it or something like that. If you want to stay away from the banking sector completely, then you can use Bitcoin ATMs, or you can buy from individuals, or you can buy from a bricks and mortar teller, over the counter type place like I'm going to have. There's a few different ways to do it.
And you're talking about not keeping it necessarily, if you got Coinbase as your entry into this, and then transferring it to another wallet, it's just for security, because we're seeing all the time how some of these people, even really big guys, are hacked into and people have their crypto stolen out of these exchange currencies. It's one of the reasons why you want to have a separate wallet, right?
Now, don't leave it on an exchange.
Yeah.
Don't leave your crypto on an actual. Once you get that, you need to have a decentralized wallet that you put your crypto on. And of course, there's even further ways to go, like hard wallets that are completely detached from the internet themselves. And you can buy those in places like Amazon. You can look for them. Mm-hmm. You can call me if you want to after the show. I'll tell you where to find one. But the first thing is just not being attached to an exchange. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most dangerous thing that you can do. Keeping it on there constantly, buy and sell, that's fine. But I never turn my, I don't think I've turned my crypto into fiat currency in like 2 years. So I'll use it to buy other things. That's why it's so important. Like when I have a payment that I want to make, like say I want to buy some more inventory for gold, I can use Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. And that's happening more and more as you're seeing, PayPal is now offering several different, this was sent to me by a supporter. He says, I've got PayPal. He says, they've got an option for us to buy four different cryptocurrencies. And so, you know, they're doing that. MasterCard is doing that. So, you know, people can stay within the cryptocurrencies. Now, you mentioned an ATM, and you said you got ATM set up over several different states.
Yeah, I do. My brother, my little brother, Andrew, has Tau Bitcoin, which we started together, and he's actually really taken the ball and ran with it, has a much larger operation than I ever had ever planned on. So he's got Bitcoin ATMs all over the United States.
Wow.
And I've got, you know, I think I just put one in Mississippi. I have to get my map out to see, but we've got Arkansas, Missouri, Texas, and I'm working on doing some more. And they're just basically kiosks. You know, you walk up, you can buy, you can sell. We can add different coins. I think some of them, we have Litecoin, Ethereum also attached to the machines. Here at my shop, I've got Litecoin, I've got Bitcoin, and you, of course, it's two ways, so you can buy or sell.
Now, you mentioned with the ATM, you can kind of do it outside the banking system somehow. So how does that work with the ATM? I've never used a crypto ATM.
Well, so there's a big portion of the American people that are not bankable. You know, they can't open a bank account. They've had credit problems in the past. They've just not able to get a bank account. They can't get it for credit reasons, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they use the ATMs to not only buy, you know, cryptocurrency, but to send cryptocurrency, you know, to make payments. And so if you're using a Bitcoin ATM, of course, you know, a legitimate company is going to ask you for your ID. It's going to know who you are. You're not going to be able to get away with being completely anonymous. But it's not going to ask you to open up a bank account. It doesn't care if you have a bank account because it's all cash.
Right.
So, you know, you go up and you, like, I want to send David Knight $100, which you should. If you're listening to this program, you should go to a Bitcoin ATM and send David Knight some money. You're going to use his wallet ID. Basically, you scan the wallet and put the $100 bill in, and that's going to process through the exchange that controls that kiosk, and it's instant.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, have you looked at the... In the infrastructure bill, there's new reporting requirements for cryptocurrency. Yes. I think it was Reason Magazine was saying this is a real problem because in a lot of cases, in order to comply with this, they don't have that information because there's some anonymity there might be in terms of, you know, who is processing this through. They may or may not know who it is that's doing that. What do you know about the reporting requirements so far? And how that's going to impact things.
I know a great deal about them. When people tell me they're going to start a Bitcoin ATM business, I wish them luck because you're going to need a lot of capital. And first thing you have to do is get an anti-money laundering policy. The second thing you're going to have to do is pick from the 1 to 3 banks in the U.S. that will actually bank you. And of course, you're going to pay a armored car service to pick up your funds. There's lots of regulation behind cryptocurrency, and of course, you know, you're going to be looked at. You're shining a light on yourself as a business, which I'm fine to do because I believe in the cryptocurrency space, and of course, you know, I'm going to comply, do all the things I have to do to be legal, you know. But I think that's a mistake people make. You know, they think everything's completely anonymous, and there are some great privacy coins. You know, nothing's completely anonymous, though. You're going to have some privacy coins like Pirate Chain that I really like, or Monero. Those are good coins, especially when you just got some wealth and you don't want to advertise that. But if you're buying meme coins, like, you know, I'm not going to name them, but if you're buying some of these meme coins, which I think is interesting, you're not anonymous at all. Everything you do is monitored. I mean, it's a very transparent transaction. And I think that's probably... that's the next wave, is for people to look more and more into privacy coins. I see that space opening up a lot, but you'll never be completely anonymous. I've listened to you interview Gotree about this, and he's right about, like, how to set up a wallet, you know, how you would, you know, start by, you could, you know, buy something with the KYC or the Know Your Customer, and then eventually transfer that crypto into something that is more anonymous and less traceable. And that is true, at least for now. But yeah, they want to, like they always do, David, they want to create an environment where only the big players can do this. I've noticed that there's, you talk about ATMs for the crypto space, it's very ubiquitous. I mean, it's just, they're launching them everywhere. And part of me is glad for that, because I think that, you know, people adopting this technology, is getting away from the fiat currency system if possible, is awesome. But I'm also skeptical. Like, Is this, are they going to inherit this entire space because they have more capital, because the regulations will make it more and more impossible, you know, for you to be a small player in this pool.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at it, like I said, cautiously optimistic on the crypto space.
Yeah. Facebook, Zuckerberg has just partnered with Coinbase for digital wallets and that type of thing. They, you know, he tried to push out what he called his stable coin Libra. Several years ago, and one of the key things about that, I thought, was in the white paper, as he's pushing this out and trying to get the approval of different governments, there was one line in there that was the key line, and he was selling it to them and saying, you know, I can make this a de facto global ID for you. And that was really what he was trying to do with this. So that's the thing. You know, we have to be very careful, watch where these people are going. It's one of the reasons why, first time I heard about Monero, I wish I had bought into it, but I didn't. But it had a big rise. I did an interview with John McAfee, and he pushed Monero in the interview. And after the interview, it shot straight up. And but I didn't get into it because I wasn't really involved in a crypto. And a lot of these meme coins, like you talk about, you know, like Dogecoin and things like that, that Elon Musk has been playing around with and manipulating. Those types of things are very, very speculative. It's just, it's kind of hard to try to figure out where you want to go in this. I'm not the kind of person who likes to gamble on the stock market, and I look at stocks as pretty much a gamble. But there is something to be said for diversifying your portfolio, especially out of the U.S. dollar. I mean, quite frankly, to leave everything in the U.S. dollar is looking to be a real sucker bet at this point in time.
Yeah. The worst possible token is the U.S. dollar. Yeah, currency.
That's kind of what Musk said. He said, yeah, is it manipulated? Yeah, of course it is. But he said the most manipulated thing that's out there is the U.S. dollar.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't want to take a chance on that. And I agree. You know, I don't gamble. Everything I invest in is kind of a slow, long-term. You know, I invest in my business, anything I can actually see, like my Bitcoin ATMs or physical metals, you know, for my inventory. I don't play too much in that arena, and I don't fault anyone that does. I mean, some people mm-hmm. have gotten extremely wealthy from doing it. I just caution people because it looks to me, you know, I put my conspiracy theorist hat on. I'm proud to be a conspiracy theorist. It's just history with common sense in it. I'm looking at this and I'm saying they're going to need a patsy and they're going to do something to take the blame away from themselves. And I think that's really what the scamdemic was all about. You know, this, and you and I talked about this before COVID, about them pumping trillions of dollars into the repo markets.
Yes.
And what was that leading to? And of course it led to COVID-1984 and then 40% of the dollars ever created. So I think, you know, a long enough timeline, we're going to see the dollar implode and we're going to see it replaced with something else. Mm-hmm. Right. The central bank digital currency, which would allow them to, in real time, control the money supply. It would also allow them to control what you bought.
Yes.
Right. Or how you spend your money. Right. And it would expire. Mm-hmm. You know, they could. Mm-hmm. There's so much they could do with that absolute control, that digitized currency. That's what they're pushing for. So part of me is, like I said, I'm looking at the future going, people adopt this. Look at this. Look at cryptocurrency. Because the more you learn about it, the more you go, wait, why do I need them? Why do I need a central bankster telling me what I can and can't process? Yes. I don't need them.
Yes.
And right. That's the freedom of crypto.
And that was the thing that was so appealing about it, was to get outside of the central bank currency where they can just print whatever they wish. I remember when they started doing this, and you know, as you point out, 40% of all the dollars ever created just created them out of nothing. And there was an interview where Powell was talking to somebody, and I had already talked about, well, imagine, if you will, a sack of dollar bills, you know, just how far would a stack of dollar bills that is $3.5 trillion, how far would that take you? Well, it would take you to the moon and a little bit back, you know, on a return trip. And so he had an interview, Powell did, the head of the Federal Reserve, and the guy said, so you're just printing money. And he goes, well, we don't really print it. We just give you digital credits for this because they don't have enough trees to print all this stuff.
Right.
You know,
fun fact, there's not enough paper.
That's right.
Yeah, really, mathematically not enough.
That's right.
Yeah, those facts and figures about how much a trillion actually is,
mm-hmm.
and I talk about this on my shows all the time. I'm like, you know, you can take a $1 bills, you print a trillion of them, you lay them end to end, it goes to the sun. done. It goes 96 million miles. And I mean, talk about numbers you can never pay back. And
yeah.
I did a breakdown live on the air a couple of weeks ago. It came to me. I was thinking about the price of gold. And, you know, gold was $300 an ounce in 2000, and the debt was about $5 trillion. Mm-hmm. You go back to the year 2000, about $5 trillion. Well, if you follow the price of gold and the debt, every time the debt doubles, gold goes with it. And I did the math all the way up to $30 trillion, and it's supposed to be about $1,800 an ounce. And, of course, it broke, you know, it's in the 1840, 1850 range because we've had it. Every time I come on your show, whether I'm hosting or whether I'm a guest, there's something massive, like some record-breaking, you know, Bitcoin's broken its record. I was hosting live for you in August of last year when gold broke its all-time high.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see gold and silver also. Well, silver has, and we'll talk about this, is something I want your listeners to know, that the major networks are never going to tell you this. They're never going to tell you about what's actually happened behind the scenes with the silver supply. But gold's breaking away. Silver's going up. I think it's a really, with people are noticing inflation.
Mm-hmm.
You just normal people, even the, what are the financial networks going to do, David, when they can't cover all this up? I mean, when they just, everything's great, go back into the market, you know, just go back, just keep investing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what I heard all the way leading up into 2008 at the crash.
Yeah.
Every financial network, and I was 28 years old and I was running a convenience store with my family in Dallas, Texas. And it was like, gas was going to $4 a gallon and we were putting in like two or three loads of fuel. That's like, you know, $80,000 a week, you know, in the ground. And you know, the credit card fees for that, which is, by the way, that's something else that people don't know. When you have runaway inflation, you have price increases. Who really benefits? The credit card companies, because they get the fees. You know, when you're buying a gallon of gasoline at $3, that's 9 cents to the credit card companies on each gallon of gas that you, when you use your card.
That's
it doesn't go to the retailer. So it was, I said, this can't end well. And every financial network was saying, no, prices are increasing, but it's not going to hurt anybody. We're good. Everything is great. Look at these numbers. And I'm going, but nobody can afford anything. And sure enough, you see it just start to tumble. And I think it's been propped up, you know, with this massive amount of quantitative easing and injections and all that stuff. But, you know, you can't really print your way to prosperity. That's mm-hmm. never worked ever. Mm-hmm. So this won't end well. And I'm cautioning people, you know, take a look at getting off the merry-go-round. And it's not really the most exciting thing to do, because if you're looking for massive returns, but it's probably a good idea to start. And this isn't financial advice, but just a good idea to start doing your own research and looking at getting into a physical metal for your savings,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily your investment. Because people ask me all the time, how much money am I going to make when I buy gold or silver? And I go, well, gold and silver are money, you know, so I don't really look at it as an investment. I think of it as like, oh, I'm just getting rid of this fake thing, you know, and I'm putting it into something that's real.
Yeah.
So,
That's right. Yeah. When we look at it and we look at what they're paying essentially zero interest rates, right? And so as you've got inflation that is really taking off, I mean, you think about the fact your bank account is just leaking money out. When they pay you absolutely no interest and the inflation is taking off. So that's another reason to get into gold, into silver, into crypto, because, again, it's the spending and the creation of the money is just out of control. So talk a little bit about in terms of coins. I know you've been very kind to send us a couple of collector's coins. You also do that. How does that fit into your investment portfolio?
Well, on the coin side, and you're talking about, I've sent you some silver dollars and sent you some bullion rounds.
Mm-hmm.
I like to diversify a little bit in that realm. I like to buy the U.S. silver dollars, especially the Morgan silver dollars, anything before the 1921s, mainly for the history. They can't make them anymore. I mean, it's impossible to make a new Morgan silver dollar. There's only so many that ever be created. And so there's a finite resource. You get the Americana, you get the history. And of course, you can hold something in your hand that actually was part of this country when this country was free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I really like that. So I keep the Morgan silver dollars. I think I've sent you a Carson City and a couple others.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the silver, just regular silver rounds, that's where I kind of transition into, I just want the metal.
Yeah,
a lot of people right now are asking me about American Eagles, and there's nothing wrong with American Eagles, but the premium on them is just insane. I tell people stay away from that if you can. What you want is the most amount of metal for your money.
That's right. Yeah, okay. So you can have collector's coins, and that's got a, you know, that's a whole nother thing. It's like if you're buying comic books or something like that, that's got a, another level that is built on top, another level of investment, really, that's a collectible aspect of it that's built on top of the actual intrinsic value. But as we've talked about this in the past, you know, if we have a situation where people are shut out of the banking system, which is not a hypothetical. I mean, that started with some of the gun manufacturers and some of the gun retailers, Operation Choke Point under the Obama administration. They're starting to do that in many other ways in terms of kicking people out via PayPal, via Venmo, other issues like that. If they start to kick people out of the banking system or restricting things because of your politics or because of your vaccination status or something like that, having some just regular silver that is not a collectible, that's going to be a key thing, even more so, I think, than gold, because as we've talked about this in the past, you need to have something that is going to have less value so that you've got something that you can more easily exchange than gold. That's going to be a couple of $1,000 one way or the other. You may not have a transaction that has that kind of value. So you can go with something that's a small fraction of that. Do they have anything that they circulate around that is less than an ounce for silver that people can pick up?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Right now, the popularity of the pre-1965 90% silver, the U.S. coinage, dimes, half dollars, quarters, and dollars, those are real popular.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing a lot of the influx of that. And if you look on the major suppliers, there a lot of them are out. So there's a lot of emphasis on buying those. You can get the divisible pieces like the dimes. And, of course, they also make, if you get with a good, you know, supplier, you can find things like quarter ounce pieces and stuff like that. You know, you can't really go wrong, though, with an ounce of silver. That's going to be, you know, ounce of silver, really, that would be like a tank of gas, mm-hmm. you know, in the next level. I call it the next, where we're headed is the next level, like this big, massive turning point, right? This fourth turning.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be going into this change, and I think people will start looking at that as money again.
Yeah,
and you can go on the street and say, "Hey, you want a $50 bill, or you want this this ounce of gold?" And people, I want the $50 bill when that's $2,000, you know, the ounce of gold. So, I think people will start to see, though, as hyperinflation sets in, as you know, they start seeing the loss of purchasing power in the dollar, and that's been true all throughout history. Every empire failed because of this. Like, this is one of the things, they start paying their debts. With inflation, with inflating the money supply and taking the value out of the coinage, out of their dollars, out of their units of spendable currency. And that's what happened. That's why they collapsed. So it's one of the reasons why. And I think we'll start seeing that more and more as people start to catch on, like, I can't buy as much. I'm not going to put these, you know, I'm not going to save dollars anymore. I'm going to put into other assets. Gold and silver will fill that void.
Yeah. You know, going back to to the Depression, the Great Depression, the original Depression before this one begins. But they had in communities, they would come together, and I think it was in North Carolina, there was an old wooden printing press. And so some of the communities would come up with like a local exchange, and they would print up some tokens, and then people in the community would use these tokens to exchange back and forth with each other. And that would just be controlled by the local association or the local government or something like that. It's a good example of what I think is likely to happen again. But if you've got something, if you've got a sufficient supply of silver, that would be far better than trying to come up with something that you could have as a physical token of exchange. But that was something that was very, very widespread during the Great Depression. Essentially, you know, the lifeline for a lot of people to be able to exchange their goods and services after the banking system had completely blocked everything up.
Yeah, and we can take the matters into our own hands. We can trade with ourselves. We don't need the government to dictate what prices are or transact anything for us. We've got gold, silver, we've got Bitcoin, we've got other cryptocurrencies. But if there's no power, right, if we're having shortages or there's something happening with the internet, then you're not going to be able to use your crypto. So the physical, I think silver is good for spending, and gold is really better for saving or housing wealth. Like if you needed to like get in the car and go mm-hmm. and your life savings had to be in something, it might need to be in gold,
mm-hmm.
you know, because mm-hmm. it's very transportable. You know, you get a few hundred ounces of silver, David, it starts to get a little heavy. You know, you're not going to be able to, especially think of those big bags of dimes, you know, you're not going to be able to go very far with that. And that's unfortunate, but that's kind of the upside is that silver is real cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at the two all-time highs that silver had is once 1980 at $50. And then again in 2011, same thing, $50. Well, $50 in 1980, as you know, is like $200 today in purchasing power. So, I mean, silver's got a long, long way to go. And here's the inside information for your listeners. If I go on the back office of the trading floor right now on my computer and I look at my account, that's only I can see, and I can see how far out an order will take. Like if you want to order 100 ounces of generic silver, I'm going to say, okay, David, that's great. Here's your price. I'll lock it in. And then the delay key next to that says unknown. So used to it just say live, like that means it's there. They'll got it direct. They're going to process my order. Now I can lock in a trade and it says 30 days or like I said, unknown or not available. Right. Wow. And I'm watching this too. This happened in the last 3 to 4 months. I'm watching this as it gets further and further out. And at the same time, it gets further and further out, David, the prices go down. You know, because if you go back to February when people were trying to drive the price of silver up by buying physical silver, the Reddit raiders and such, you know, everybody was calling me and I was trying to get their hands on physical silver. The next day it went down. Hmm. And that's after like my phone melted. People were, I mean, we're trying to do so many trades and I'm going, well, how did it go down? Well, you go and look and the big bullion houses, right? They sold 1.5 times the annual supply of silver in one day to keep that price down because these industrialists and the large banks need silver to be cheap.
Yep.
They don't want you.
Yep.
They don't want you looking at it. It's not in their best interest for you to own precious metals. It's their best interest for you to be in the casino.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell people like, hey, look, this might be a good time for you to take a look at gold and silver IRAs or rolling over a 401k into metals, at least stop the music, right? Because the thing is, you don't want to be left holding the bag when they finally inflated this thing into oblivion and it pops.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what's, they've built an entire economy off things that don't make money. There's a bunch of the major corporations on there that they're not even in the black. They don't make a profit.
Oh yeah.
And that's something that didn't happen, you know, when you were coming up, you know, when I was born, you still had to make, you know, instead of make money, you still had to actually turn a profit. But now everything's kind of in the ether and, you know, well, it's an idea, you know, and they're propped up with the central bank and they pick winners and losers. This is not a good time to be in the stock market, in my opinion.
Yeah, we've seen this and it became apparent to us when we were working. We had our video stores and we were competing against Blockbuster Video. And after they were very profitable when Wayne Huizenga, the guy had Waste Management Industries. And so he bought it. It was a great idea that a guy had. And so he bought it. He started expanding it. And then he sold it to Sumner Redstone, who had Viacom, CBS, Paramount, that big media holding company. But after it was bought by Viacom, they didn't make any money after that. And they operated forever because just these corporations, just as the government can operate with the Federal Reserve creating money out of thin air, these corporations can operate creating money out of thin air on Wall Street. They, as long as they come up with a happy story, they just keep getting investors in. And we saw this with Moderna. For 10 years, they never had a product. But they would come up with happy stories about some product that they had in development, and they would get massive amounts of money poured into the company. And so you have, they've basically, with their monopoly status and with the ability to raise money on Wall Street, they don't really have to compete. They don't really have to turn a profit. So you have this kind of monopoly capitalism is really taking away everything that we always understood about a competitive free market. That's really what happens on Main Street with mom and pop out there trying to offer better services. These people are trying to please the government. They're trying to create a story for the stock market. And that's really where they're operating. That's why they're so tone deaf to anything that people want to have. That's why they're pushing these woke agendas, because they can get away with anything. They don't care if you buy their product because they've already got a monopoly. And that's why I think that we're really going to see this. It's another aspect, not just the profligate spending of the federal government, but the fact that you have these corporations who have really broken the connection to supplying people with goods and services that they want to do. And the two of them are going to be working on creating scarcity. That's going to also feed into this hyperinflation stuff. So I think it's going to be a very challenging time for those of us who are not multinational corporations coming up in the next few years. And that's why I think it's important for people to talk about this. GoatTree contacted me and said, hey, we need to talk about this. I know you've been doing this for quite some time. We really need people need to understand some of the things that they can do to try to hedge against these things that are coming in, to try to diversify how they are holding money. You know, one of the things you mentioned, Tony, about if you got to get on the go and you got so much silver, you're not going to be able to get your car to blow the tires out, you know, if you try to take that stuff with you. That's one of the things I see over and over again in these civil asset forfeiture situations. You have people who don't know what's going on, and they'll take cash with them, paper, you know, Federal Reserve notes with them to go buy something for their business. And they'll take they usually get caught at the airport. Maybe they're going to fly somewhere and they're going to buy some kind of a commercial truck from somebody. So they're taking cash with them to do that. And they get all their cash confiscated. I think that's another aspect of cryptocurrency. When you talk about having these external wallets, the physical wallet or something like that, you know, you can take that stuff with you on the wallet instead of having to take physical cash or even physical coins around with you.
Yeah, if you're going to leave the country, crypto, understanding that is very important, you know, because you're going to have a hard time getting out with gold. Although I would say one of the strategies people I've seen do is the pre-33 U.S. gold coins, taking those and putting them in jewelry for your wife or yourself. You know, you have it in a bezel. You can have it on bracelets. You can put all these coins. You have a lot of gold. It'll stack up pretty well. You're going to look kind of gaudy. You'll look a little ridiculous, but you'll have a ton of gold on you. And it's technically jewelry, you know, so you can get on a plane. If you have a lot of wealth, I mean, you're going to need crypto.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, like I said, silver is heavy, but it's a really important metal to have for the daily usage. I think you'll see people ask me that all the time. Like, how are we going to value it? And I'm like, you'll just know. I mean, you'll just know, like, you know, a silver dime is probably a loaf of bread. You know, it'll just even out. It has a way of doing that.
Well, it just breaks my heart when I cover these stories about somebody who, you know, they don't understand how the crypto stuff works. They don't know that they could, you know, go from one state to the other to buy their car. Maybe the person on the other side wouldn't know about that. So they just take a big stack of cash with them. And it's a big surprise to them that, you know, somebody at the airport, either a TSA agent or call the DEA, and they'll say, well, I think that's a drug transaction, and just take all of it from them. And that's the key thing. We don't want to have ourselves in a situation where there are some tools that we could use that would be available to us that we're unable to use simply because we're ignorant about how the thing operates. And so I'm really glad to hear that you're doing a bricks and mortar approach to help help people to set up a wallet to understand how some of this stuff works, just so they understand some of the mechanics about it and how they can figure out how to do it from a safe standpoint, you know, so that it's not so they're not vulnerable to hackers and things like that. That's great to hear that. Well, thank you so much for coming on with us. And of course, I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to take a little bit of time and I'm going to have Tony do the show if we're able to take a couple of days off. And always he has very interesting things to talk about. We always just talk about gold and silver and crypto whenever you come on. But Tony does a regular show. Where can people find your show, Tony?
You can go to arterburn.news. It has the podcast link up there. I do a show on Worldwide Christian Radio a couple, three times a week. That's the Arterburn Radio transmission. And I just started, I'm about 11 episodes into the Wise Wolf Gold and Crypto Show. As I said, you know, everybody's talking about gold on one side or Bitcoin on the other. And I go, well, let's just combine them. Let's just say that, can we agree that fiat is garbage? And so I started a new show, and aftermath.fm picked it up, and we do Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Aftermath.fm, by the way, you know, we're on there as well. So it's good that you're putting both of these things together. I really like that because, you know, we got the people like Peter Schiff on one side, that's all gold and anti-crypto. You got Max Kaiser, who's all crypto and anti-gold, or all Bitcoin, I should say. He doesn't just do crypto. He's all Bitcoin very specifically. So it's great to have both of those things involved. And I think, you know, people, we're not giving anybody any investment advice, but we're just trying to help you to understand what options are out there. And this is going to be, I think, as we both know, the bankers are at the bottom of all of this, and that's really the hidden hand as to what is happening. And that is going to rear its head in a very, very ugly way before too much longer. And so people need to keep that in mind as they look at these other ways where they can, you know, try to survive and have something that is left over after they come in and try to wipe everything out. Thank you so much for joining us, Tony. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, David. Appreciate you.
Wisewolf.gold. We'll be right back. Stay with us, folks.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.
Elvis.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
And the sweet sounds of Motown. Find them on the Oldies channel at APSradio.com.
All right, and welcome back. I want to talk in a little bit of time that we have left about racism of inanimate objects. I was just talking to Tony, and we mentioned civil asset forfeiture. And, you know, one of the most glaring absurdities before all this stuff started happening this last year, to me, was the idea that as part of civil asset forfeiture, they would charge assets, you know, inanimate objects with crimes. You know, so you would see when they would steal something from somebody without even charging them with a crime, let alone finding them guilty of something, it would be the U.S. government versus $9,000 cash, or the U.S. government versus Learjet serial number, blah, 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 or a house at a particular address, or a car, or whatever. They would charge the inanimate object with a crime. And so, lo and behold, here we are in the Biden administration, where you have people in academia, in universities, as well as Pete Buttigieg. All these individuals are now charging inanimate objects with racism. That's right. They're racist. The roads are racist. We have trees, or the lack of trees. That's racist, according to Kamala Harris. But you have Pete Buttigieg, in terms of a press conference that he had. There was a White House correspondent, they call her. Her name is April Ryan. I find it amusing that she is listed as a blogger. She's not with one of these establishment media organizations. She's just a blogger. But if you are politically correct enough, you know, you can get into the White House press corps and you can ask insane questions like this, which is really just kind of a softball tee-up question for Pete Buttigieg, talking about racist highways. And she asked Pete Buttigieg how he would deconstruct the racism that was built into the roadways. Now just think about this. I mean, how many years back would we have to go until people would just roll their eyes and not even have a clue as to how to deconstruct this absurdity that she just said? How are you going to deconstruct racism that is built into our roadways? But he's right there. This is a softball question that was put up to him. So he says, so the principle of Justice 40 is that at least 40% of the clean investments in this bill will go to benefit communities that are overburdened and underserved. And so we have these people are talking about things like climate justice or infrastructure justice or Justice 40 or social justice. And as we've had some people point out, there is no preface to justice if there is justice, right? There isn't such a thing as social justice. You have justice or you don't have justice. When they use justice in that way, they're just using it to further their political agenda. They're not really talking about justice at all. And they're not talking about equal protection under the law. They're not talking about anything other than redistribution. And that's exactly what he's talking about here. This is simply Marxism. And Booty Gay likes to make a big issue about the fact that he is gay. But nobody ever talks about the fact that he's Marxist. I talk about it. I've called him Booty Marx because that's really what this guy is truly about. His father made at Notre Dame University, a professor there, made a career out of studying the guy who established Italian Marxism. And then, of course, you know, the Italian Marxists were some of the anarchists that came to the U.S. in the early 20th century. Sacco and Vanzetti were celebrities to the Marxist crowd. They considered them to be wrongfully convicted. I don't think that was the case, but they became heroes to the Marxist left. And so when his Marxist father sent him to study under someone, he sent him to Harvard to study under a guy who had changed his name to Sacvan. He changed his first name to Sacvan in order to honor Sacco and Vanzetti. So he was Sacvan Berkovich, and he was the mentor of Booty Gay. And the basic premise of Sacvan was that all of the ills of America were based on our Christian foundation, and that had to be deconstructed. It had to be torn apart. It had to be reduced by criticism. And so when they talk about deconstruction, that's typically the kind of deconstruction they're talking about. Coming after and ideologically attacking something like Christianity or just other foundations of our civilization. But they're really talking about literally deconstructing these highways, knocking down roads and bridges that they say are racist. He goes on to say this: if you have an underpass that was constructed such that a bus carrying mostly black and Puerto Rican kids to a beach in New York was designed too low for it to pass by, that obviously reflects racism that went into those design choices, he says. I mean, is this incredibly stupid or what? But this is the kind of prevarication that they're going to use to push their agendas. And the agenda is really about corruption and crony capitalism. They'll just be using this racism as a way to channel money to their friends. Nobody ever designed roads and bridges based on skin color, but these people will be knocking them down and justifying it based on skin color. In response to that, this blogger, April Ryan, says, well, if you're going to, you know, this Justice 40 thing you're going to do, that's a really heavy lift. I mean, you'd have to reconstruct communities that this happened to. As you said, some of these beltways and interstates and roadways were built before the Civil Rights Act. And you know what? They probably need to have the potholes fixed, and they probably needed to have the bridges shored up. But instead, they're not going to do that. Instead, they're going to spend a lot of money in this infrastructure bill. Instead of fixing physical infrastructure, they're going to be setting up a Marxist infrastructure. Again, everything is about racism. Look at the University of Minnesota. They have an architecture professor there talking about design justice. They always love to throw justice in. These people are not about justice. Not at all. And so the idea about design justice is that we need to seek to create space, policy, and practices that support the inclusion and the retention of black, indigenous, and people of color. How does that factor into architecture? See, everything is about racism to these people, just like this CEO of Pfizer, who is saying, well, you know, these people who are not, who don't support our project, our product, they're actually killing people. It's like, no, pal, your product is killing people. And you're the criminal, not the people who expose your crimes. But it applies to everything, even steam trains, especially, you know, there's a whole hobby of train spotters looking at ancient, at older trains in the UK. But now they're saying that steam trains are now declared to be racist. Why? Well, because it allowed us to build our society. Anything that built up America. It's not just the steam trains, but it's also the interstate system that would bypass a neighborhood because people didn't want a lot of traffic in their neighborhood and because people didn't want to be held up driving through a neighborhood. All of these types of things are now being declared racist. It is not about justice. It is about destroying our society, and that includes destroying our infrastructure. And it's about rewarding their friends. This kind of redistribution of wealth. Railways are critical to the expansion of colonial power across Asia, Africa, as well as the North American interior. So they have to be destroyed because they don't want anything, any infrastructure that is going to allow us to live our lives, to feed our families. That's what we're really facing. That's it for the broadcast today. Thank you for listening.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project, to make sure the commoners own nothing, and the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. thedavidknightshow.com.